Let's get together, talk about the movies that we saw this week. We'll have discussions, talk film news, we'll laugh a lot and act like geeks. Sometimes we'll have a guest or two, sometimes it's just the two of us. Let's crack some jokes and tell some folks to come along and hang with us!
Mike and Mike go to the movies. Mike and Mike go to the movies, yeah!
You have chosen wise.
Hello and welcome to the podcast that, when you say a magic word, turns into a real podcast. like, you know, WTF with Mark Maron or something.
Yeah.
But we don't know the magic word, though, so it's Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a new champion who is pure of heart.
Mike DeCrescia.
How are you doing today, Mike?
You know, I'm feeling just swell. You think I'm pure of heart? That's nice. Like, what a nice boost.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
Absolutely, man. I bestow that upon to you, the gift of, well, we'll get to that later. and so before we get into anything else, so we should say at the top of the show, we were supposed to have a guest on this episode, Jordan Rodriguez. Want to give a shout out to Jordan, who was on with us for the hour before we recorded this episode, the entire hour, trying to figure out how to record his end of the podcast through no fault of his own. It was all technology based. Turns out Chromebook doesn't record audio that well.
Yeah, who knew?
Or at all, apparently. So shout out to Jordan, who was very excited to be on the podcast, and who went out and watched Shazam and, you know, did all these things, and like he had his discussions prepared. I think he watched Beetlejuice, which was one of his discussions, twice before before this episode, because he wanted to be prepared for it.
Yeah, he had notes, which is more than I've ever had.
Exactly. So. Yeah. So we feel really bad about it, you know, but we spent like an hour troubleshooting the problem. And yeah, it just turns out like if you have a microphone plugged into Chromebook and you're using Skype, it won't record anything else, which is insane. That seems like
thanks, Google.
Yeah, it seems like a pretty terrible design flaw. but in any case, that is the issue. So unfortunately, Jordan, you couldn't make it on this episode. We apologize for that, but we will have you on at some point in the future once we sort out all of the tech problems, which are all on your side. So really, you should sort them out, and we'll just let us know when they're fixed.
Yeah, great apology, Mike.
I think that was very, you know, I don't have to apologize. It was his fault. I feel like if Jordan's listening to this right now, his emotions must be going all over the place. But anyway, wow. So yeah, once again, sorry, Jordan. We will have you on again in the near future.
Yes.
Or again, on
yes.
For the first time in the near future. credit for all our theme songs goes to Kyle Cullen. If you want to contact us, you can send us an email at mikeandmikegotothemovies@gmail.com. Don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes or Apple Podcasts if you can, since it helps people find the show and makes us feel good about ourselves when we get those good reviews. And if you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news and then move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately, and then after that we move on into our featured review. Today that's going to be a new movie directed by David F. Sandberg and the 7th overall film in the DC Extended Universe, Shazam! Are you excited to dig into Shazam, Mike?
I am.
Yeah, I gotta say, I mean, my reaction to this movie is already on Twitter. I won't get into it here to spoil, you know, what we thought about the movie later, but I will just say I'm pretty pumped to talk about this movie.
I would agree.
So yeah, we'll do that in a little bit for our review of Shazam. Right now, let's get into some film news.
Hi! It's time for...
What?
It's time for...
Alright, it's time for film news here on Film Bookcast. So we got a few things I wanted to get through. Some superhero stuff, of course. We've talked about James Gunn a lot over the last few episodes, about how he got rehired for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 in a pretty surprise move by Disney. But before he gets back on the Guardians train, he is jumping over to DC to make The Suicide Squad, which will be the sort of sequel, sort of reboot, whatever have you, of to Suicide Squad, which came out in 2016. And early reports seem to indicate this would be like a full-on reboot, pretty much.
Right.
And now it's looking like it's less of a reboot and more of like a sequel that will probably not acknowledge the original anyway. that's
the best kind of sequel.
Yeah. I mean, for Suicide Squad, I feel like that's probably the best direction to go.
Yeah, true.
Because honestly, like a full-on reboot of Suicide Squad, like, you know, you've got characters there that were cool and like could potentially work in a better movie. And, you know, I would have been fine with a full-on reboot, but so soon after the original Suicide Squad just seems like a lot. Now it's looking like a few cast members from the original movie will be back for this one, including Viola Davis, who played Amanda Waller in that movie, Jai Courtney, who is Captain Boomerang, and I think he was kind of, as far as fan-favorite characters of Suicide Squad go, he must have been the biggest one except for Harley Quinn, right?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
You know, I say that as if Suicide Squad has fan-favorite characters.
and one of them could possibly be Jai Courtney.
So Jai Courtney will be back as Captain Boomerang, and then also Joel Kinnaman, who was Rick Flagg in that movie. The soldier who kind of corralled the Suicide Squad or whatever. I remember nothing about him. I remember that he was friends with Katana, right? Because
something like that.
Because there's that one line he has where it's like, "This is Katana. She's got my back."
Right.
I'd recommend not getting killed by her sword.
That eats souls and will never mention it again.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah, so he's back. Yeah, sure, why not? Honestly, none of this, Viola Davis is a great actress, so, bringing her back, sure, that seems like a no-brainer. If anybody was going to return from the original Suicide Squad, that would make the most sense, because she's the one who's in charge of the Suicide Squad.
Yeah, yeah.
But then as far as this goes, Joel Kinnaman, I wouldn't have even noticed if he didn't come back for Suicide Squad 2. And Jai Courtney, Captain Boomerang was fun in that movie,
yeah, that's
right?
True.
So, I could be down for that. And I think, if there's a different take on him that James Gunn brings to it, I think that would be kind of refreshing. And then it turns out Idris Elba is not playing Deadshot in the movie after all. We had reported a little while ago that Idris Elba was going to be replacing Will Smith as Deadshot. Turns out right. That's not going to be the case, but there's no reveal on who he is playing. The rumors abound that he might be Bronze Tiger, who is a character that was played by Michael Jai White in the Arrow TV show on the CW.
Wow.
Who is a pretty cool character there. And so, yeah, it doesn't really, that again doesn't really matter to me. I think this is kind of their way of doing Idris Elba, he's great. But we don't really necessarily want to get rid of Will Smith in case he ever wants to come back for these movies, what I mean? I think that's sort of that hedging their bets a little bit. So it sounds like he won't be in this one. But who knows? Maybe, what is it?
He'll be in the post-credit scene or some stupid shit.
Or Aladdin tanks and he needs to,
he needs to
get in Suicide Squad 3. That's a live-action Disney remake, so, it probably won't tank. Although, Dumbo didn't do too well, so we'll... So I guess we'll see what happens. I think Aladdin will probably be fine. But man, the trailers do not instill a ton of confidence in me. I gotta say.
I think it'd be fun for Suicide Squad to just have their characters die at the end of every movie and just be recast as new people as the same characters in every other movie. You know what I mean? Don't be beholden to a greater universe. It's the Suicide Squad. Who gives a shit? I think that'd be a really funny and fun way to do that. It's never going to happen.
just every Suicide Squad movie, every character is Kenny from South Park, basically.
Yeah, yeah. They're just back with no explanation as to why in the next one.
And they're all played by different actors every time.
Yeah, who cares which one is Deadshot and which actor plays Deadshot? Yeah. He's back. That's all.
Yeah, fair enough. So, yeah, that is the updates on the Suicide Squad. And then also over on the Marvel side of things, they are gearing up their casting process. They started casting Black Widow and they started casting the Eternals. So Black Widow, I know David Harbour is part of that now from Stranger Things. And Florence Pugh, who's just Paige in Fighting With My Family, the wrestling movie, she's also going to be in there somewhere. But over on the Eternals side, things are looking nuts. there's two names that I've seen attached to the Eternals, and we don't know anything about the characters they'll be playing. But apparently Angelina Jolie is in talks for this movie, which she barely stars in movies anymore. The last 10 years, she's been in the Maleficent movies, and that's it. She was directing her own art house kind of stuff for a while. But so that would be a pretty huge get for Marvel, I think, because she's still a major star. And also she very rarely appears in movies. And then the other name thrown around, which is the polar opposite of Angelina Jolie, is Kumail Nanjiani.
He's having a real good year, man.
Dude, Kumail Nanjiani, star of the first episode of the Jordan Peele's Twilight Zone.
Right.
And he's possibly in the Eternals. And what else? He's been doing a lot of stuff. Silicon Valley's coming back soon.
That movie with...
Batista, right?
Dave Bautista, yeah.
Yes, he and Drax.
I forget what it's called. Together,
Stuber, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Which actually looks like it could be pretty funny. I did see the trailer for that. And, you know, he just had the big sick a couple years ago. It's nuts to think about, like, you know, Kumail Nanjiani was a guy, was mostly a guy who, like, hosted an X-Files podcast. Like, that was his...
yeah. Yes,
that would be like if one of us got cast in the Eternals, you know, like if like Kevin Feige was listening into our Nicolas Cage podcast and been like, you know what, these are the guys,
this is them,
we're casting them as Star-Lord and Adam Warlock, like we're in the Guardians of the Galaxy reboot or something, like
yep, in the second spinoff of the Suicide Squad movie.
Right, because Kevin Feige will jump ship over there too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Once Disney buys DC.
Oh, yeah, good point.
I made it sad.
Yeah, you did. But yeah, so I mean, that it's anytime Kumail Nanjiani just appears in something, I'm always like, good for you, guy. Like, yo,
yeah, you did it, man.
Because I've been following his stand up for years. I used to listen to the Indoor Kids a little bit. Like when he and Emily Gordon were, you know, nominated for an Oscar, I was like, this is crazy. This is nuts.
Yeah.
And so yeah, now Kumail Nanjiani could be the star of his own Marvel franchise. Which would be pretty insane to think about. Like, you know, like literally like 5 years ago, he was hosting that X-Files podcast, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty quick.
Anyway. So yeah, that is, the casting news on the comic book movie side. Let's talk about some non-comic book stuff right now. Baz Luhrmann. Mike, where do you fall in the films of Baz Luhrmann?
He definitely makes movies that are like sort of musicals. That's it.
I mean, yeah, no, you're right. I mean, Moulin Rouge is probably his most well-known. He also did The Great Gatsby with Leo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire. That was actually the last movie he made, which was 6 years ago at this point.
Wow.
I'm not the biggest Baz Luhrmann fan. I think one of my hottest takes is that Moulin Rouge is not a very good movie.
Wow, that is a very hot take.
I've had so many girlfriends get angry at me about that. About that in the past, you have no
how
idea.
How could you say something so brave yet so controversial?
I think it's the other way around.
Yeah, but, YOLO.
Yeah, so I mean, Moulin Rouge, like, I'm not the biggest fan of. I do kind of like his first movie, Strictly Ballroom. I think that's a solid time. But even that, like, just it, like, to me, Baz Luhrmann's style gets in the way of everything. Like, his I think his production design is amazing, but like just the quick editing and the obnoxiousness, like there's this obnoxiousness to his stuff that I find very grating. But you know, I'm always like curious about his stuff. I don't know why. Like, I'm always just like intrigued by what he comes out with.
Yeah, there's something like alluring about it. Like, oh, I just got to know what's going on, and then you're like, oh yeah, it's this. And then, but the next time you're like, I just got to know.
Yeah, exactly. I know he had a Netflix TV show a couple years ago called The Get Down, which was supposed to be really good. Actually, I've heard good things about that. I never watched it, but that was one of those things. I think Netflix canceled after one season. In any case, this will be his first movie since The Great Gatsby in 2013, and it's an Elvis Presley biopic, which would feature Tom Hanks as Elvis's manager, not as Elvis. Although,
oh man,
how much money would I give to see Tom Hanks play Elvis? Like, you have no idea.
But like sad fat Elvis, that'd be great.
That actually would be kind of amazing. But yeah, this would be Tom Hanks playing Elvis's manager, Colonel Tom Parker, who's kind of a legendarily sleazy manager. One of my discussions features a very rare Tom Hanks kind of sleazeball role. It's very rare that you see Tom Hanks kind of take on that kind of persona in his movies. Like, he's literally playing Mr. Rogers in an upcoming movie. Like, he's that's his persona. That's Tom Hanks. He's America's dad, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I always like when he gets to get a little, like, you know, evilish in his movies. There's like a bit in Cloud Atlas where he has like plays like a couple of evil guys, and it's like he's a lot of fun doing those kind of roles. So I could actually see him doing this kind of manager role really well. And Elvis biopic, I mean, there's been a couple of these in the past. Kurt Russell did one with John Carpenter in the 70s.
Wait a second, hold on.
Did you not know about that?
That was the greatest sentence that anyone has ever uttered in the English language.
This is
holy
a movie that
shit.
You did not know about this.
No.
Oh, nice. Man. Yeah, no, 79. Kurt Russell and John Carpenter made a TV movie together. It was the first movie they ever made together. And it's like this 3-hour long Elvis biopic.
We got to pause the podcast, and I'm going to come back with a new discussion.
Just wait 3 hours for you to watch this Elvis movie. But yeah, so there has been Elvis biopics in the past. It's kind of what I was getting at there. And I think, you know, if Baz Luhrmann doing his take on it could be interesting. If it's anything like other Baz Luhrmann movies, I probably won't like it, but I'll probably end up seeing it because I'm always like intrigued by his stuff anyway. I don't understand what it is that pulls me in. But yeah, so that is Baz Luhrmann's upcoming project, which will be an Elvis biopic. And then I want to talk about a project that I'm actually very curious about. I'm excited about it, definitely excited, but I feel like I'm more curious than excited just because of what's going on here. Joel Coen of Coen Brothers fame, like, you know. You know, the Coen brothers, Joel and Ethan Coen. They've made...
The writer and director of Garfield.
I believe he was only the writer of Garfield, actually.
Ah, that's right. You're right. Correct.
Yeah, in case you're unfamiliar, there are two Joel Coens in Hollywood and two Ethan Coens in Hollywood.
Really?
Yes. There's, or I think one of them's Ethan Coen and one of them's Ethan Coen. Ethan Coen is the good one. but Joel... Yeah, I think Ethan Coen was the guy who directed Get Hard with Will Ferrell and Kevin Hart a couple years ago.
Oh my God!
Yeah, and Joel Coen is the one who wrote Garfield the movie, which Bill Murray starred in. Neither of them are of the Coen brothers. They are two unrelated Coens that are also not related to the Coen brothers. but Joel and Ethan Coen together—that's the pair that you want. Those are the good.
That's
guys,
the good right stuff.
There. Big Lebowski, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, Ballad of Buster Scruggs, all that stuff. Anyway, Joel Coen is going solo for his next movie, which is like insane. I saw that and I was like, I had like. A little bit of a panic attack.
Yeah, you got scared.
I got scared. I was like, what kind of falling out did the Coen brothers have? Like,
oh my God.
And it kind of reminded me, I mean, one of the big things of Inside Llewyn Davis. I remember when that movie came out. Have you seen Inside Llewyn Davis?
No, I haven't, actually.
Okay, well, the plot of Inside Llewyn Davis is that Oscar Isaac plays this folk singer who used to be in a group, but his partner died. And so the movie is about him kind of dealing with the loss of his partner and in that way. And so I think it was Matt Singer actually who tweeted out something that like kind of blew up on Twitter when the movie came out. And it's been stuck in my head ever since, where he said, I think Inside Llewyn Davis is the Coens imagining life without each other. And people saw that and they're like, holy shit. Like it changed the entire perception of the movie, in some ways. And so when I saw this news, I was like, oh my God, what's happening? Like what kind of Inside Llewyn Davis shit is going on right now? But, but I like, as far as I know, like they haven't like commented specifically about why they're doing this, but as far as I know, it's just something that like Joel Coen wanted to do this. Maybe Ethan Coen was working on something else and they didn't come together, but it sounds like Joel Coen is going to solo direct a new adaptation of Macbeth, starring Denzel Washington as Macbeth and Frances McDormand as Lady Macbeth. Now, Frances McDormand is Joel Coen's wife, and I think that might be why he's doing this solo. Like, it might just be like a thing, like, hey, let's do this, like on the side while we're preparing our other thing, like that. But that might be what's going on. You know, that's my best guess.
Yeah, this kind of rings of just like a fun side project that these particular people want to go do with them like together.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me. It kind of reminds me of when Joss Whedon did Much Ado About Nothing, right? His like black and white thing with like his like troop of actors that he did like while he was in post production on the Avengers type thing,
like at his house or something.
Exactly. Yeah. So this could be kind of a similar deal.
Yeah, you know, I mean, but that's like that combination of actors and subject, like, hell yeah, that sounds amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very curious to see how this plays out. Like, if it'll be like if they'll play it straight, do like a straight adaptation of Macbeth with Denzel and Frances McDormand, or if Joel Coen will like, you know, have like this Coen brothers kind of take on it. Like, if maybe it'll be like an Oh Brother, Where Art Thou type thing, where it's like sort of based on the Odyssey, but sort of not. You know what I mean? And it's like its own thing. So I'm like, we know nothing about this other than it's Macbeth. It's got Denzel and Frances McDormand, and it's going to be directed by Joel Coen. But like that's a pretty insane amount of names and title to kind of lump together. You know what I mean?
It'd be great if it's also set in Depression era South, and Babyface Nelson is in it.
And it's just like and it's just a sequel to Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah, how great would that be?
I would not be against it. I used to rank that as my favorite Coen Brothers movie. Like for a long time, that was my number one. I kind of got supplanted by Barton Fink as I got older, but Oh Brother, Where Art Thou was still high up there for me. It's a great movie.
Yeah, maybe Macbeth will be there. Although
could be
with an asterisk.
With an asterisk, because it's only one Coen brother. Although what I want to see happen now is Ethan Coen like also doing his own like rival Shakespeare adaptation, and having them go like head to head on like they open on the same weekend or something. It'll be like a Flags of Our Fathers, Letters from Iwo Jima type situation.
Yeah, he comes out with like Hamlet or something.
Yeah. Yeah, or it'd be even better if, like, Joel Coen was doing Hamlet and Ethan Coen was doing Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, and they kind of, like...
Oh, my God.
And they, like, coincided in the halfway point. I think that'd be pretty wild. Unfortunately, I don't think that's what's going to happen, but we'll keep you updated on this as time goes on, because I am very curious what a solo Coen movie kind of looks like.
Yeah.
So that's pretty wild. And then finally, I got one last bit of film news, Mike. Just kind of a quick casting update for a movie we haven't really talked about much at all, but it's coming out in June. A remake of Child's Play is hitting theaters, which stars Aubrey Plaza and Brian Tyree Henry.
To be honest, I didn't know this was even a thing.
I saw a trailer for it, I think before I saw Us, actually. And that was the first time I had seen a trailer for it. And then as soon as I saw the trailer for that, the next trailer was for Annabelle 3. And I was like, what is happening?
Yeah, wait a second.
What is this? Especially, they're coming out within like a couple of weeks of each other, too, which is great.
Really?
It's like the same movie. But anyway, they're doing a remake of Child's Play. And they're not having Brad Dourif play Chucky anymore. Brad Dourif played Chucky in every single Chucky movie up to this point. Including, like, they were still making Chucky movies up until like 2 years ago. Like, there was another one. That I heard was pretty good. So anyway, they were casting Brad Dourif, and so some people are kind of upset about that, but they are getting a pretty crazy good replacement for it, and that is Mark Hamill is playing Chucky in the new movie.
What?
Yeah,
that's,
man.
That's amazing.
That is pretty awesome right there, actually. Like, I mean, I figure, you know, you gotta figure, like, he's probably gonna be summoning a lot of his Joker in that kind of role, but I feel like he'll take like it'll be like a different kind of spin on it. Like, it won't just be the Joker again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's a pretty well versed voice actor, so I think he's going to do a great job.
Yeah, exactly. I think some people saw this news and only knew him for Star Wars and were like, "Mark, like Luke Skywalker's voice, Chucky? That doesn't make any sense."
Oh my god!
Like, but like, it's one of those things where it's like, if you've been paying attention to voice acting at all over the last like 30 years, then you'll know that Mark Hamill's like the guy. He's
yeah,
you know, his Joker is legendary. In some circles, he is more as known for Joker as he is for Luke Skywalker. I mean, in pop culture, definitely it's Luke. Like, it's
right.
You know, but you know, as far as like iconic Joker performances go, he is the guy. That's why they kept bringing him back. Like, you know, he did it on Batman the Animated Series way back in the day, and they kept bringing him back for so many other things. And like, I remember when they brought him into Arkham City. And that was going to be, like, Batman Arkham City, the video game. That was going to be his last time playing the Joker. And then they brought him back for Arkham Knight, right?
Right.
And then after that, they brought him back again for, like, the Dark Knight Returns video, a DVD thing or whatever. and it's, you know?
I think he was also in the Killing Joke they put out in theaters.
That's what I was thinking of, actually. The Killing Joke, not Dark Knight Returns. But yeah, the Killing Joke, which was just a couple years ago. Like, he keeps saying he's going to retire the Joker character, but he's so good at it that they keep, like, bringing him back for more things.
It's nuts.
So yeah, hell yeah, let Mark Hamill play Chucky. That's a cool casting choice.
What a hashtag that would be. Although it's happening, so
yeah, it's happening. It doesn't need to be a hashtag anymore. Anyway, so yeah, that is the film news for today. Just a couple of cool things thrown out there, and now let's move on, Mike, into our discussion.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're gonna talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions here on Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
Today, I have quite a host of things to talk about, Mike.
Yeah, a plethora of things.
A veritable potpourri, even.
A cornucopia, if you will.
Well, first of which is Goliath Season 2, which is available on Amazon Prime.
Okay, I remember you talked about Season 1 a while back on the podcast.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if there is going to be a Season 3, but I think Season 2 has been out for
a while, right?
Number of months. Yeah, I watched Season 1, I think, last summer or something like that. It was a while ago.
Yeah.
And this is Billy Bob Thornton, plays, you know, washed up. Drunk lawyer in Santa Monica, California.
Yeah.
And in Season 2, he gets embroiled in the, you know, drug cartels. It's this big police cover-up kind of thing. And it's a lot of fun. It's a lot more intense than Season 1. Season 1 is this, like, very legal... Like, it's a legal drama about, like, you know, this big legal, like, the biggest law firm in the country protecting this corporate client kind of thing. And this is... more like down and dirty, corrupt cops, you know, kind of thing. So it's a little more action. Not that there is action, but it's more grimy, I guess, in some weird way. And it's fun. The supporting cast, all this, like, supporting cast from season one is back. And the new characters are a lot of fun. Mark Duplass is in this as one of the villains, which
really?
Is, like, the most inspired casting choice, because it's fucking weird, dude.
That's cool. I remember he was in a movie called Creep a couple years ago, and that was, like, a villainous role from him. And, like, I remember he was, like, really good in it.
Yeah, I never saw that, but I did hear a lot about it. I think there's, like, two or three of them now.
There's definitely a Creep 2. I'm not, I think they were working on a Creep 3, but yeah.
Maybe that's what it was, yeah. But yeah, he's this, like, kind of real estate mogul guy that's, like, embroiled in everything that's going on. And he's just so fucking weird. And there's, like, season one had this, too, where there's just this, like, weird fetish, sexual fetish aspect that's, like, this storyline that's, like, woven throughout this, like, tense legal drama.
Okay.
And it's Mark Duplass's character in this one is involved in that. And, like, to say it's about amputees and stuff.
Okay.
And it's, yeah, and it's, like, Mark Duplass, though? Like, the guy, like, you? the funny guy doing this,
Mr. Funny Man over here.
Yeah, but yeah, it's pretty cool. If you watch season one of Goliath, I would definitely recommend season two. It's kind of like more of the same, but a little more up the ante a little bit.
Okay, nice.
Yeah, that's on Amazon Prime. Next thing I want to talk about is called a movie called Good Luck, Miss Wyckoff.
Okay, this is one of your Vinegar Syndrome discs.
Yes, this is one of the Blu-rays I got from Vinegar Syndrome, you know, the boutique Blu-ray publisher or whatever I mentioned last time. This is from 1979, and this is this, like, erotic race relations drama thing. I don't really know. I kind of bought it on a recommendation. The guys from Vinegar Syndrome were on another podcast on, I think, Shockwaves was where I heard it. And They kind of just, like, ask the guys from Vinegar Syndrome, what are some movies you wish sold more? And this was one of them, so I was like, ah, fuck it, I'll buy it. And, like, man, I'm not sure it's good. I don't think it's very good. So I get why it doesn't sell a whole lot of copies.
Yeah.
It sounded like, when I first read the back of it, I read the synopsis, I thought it was going to be, like, this kind of goofy, maybe not goofy's not the right word. You know, like, kind of that kind of era, like, you know, late 70s kind of slimy, weird movies
that are
sort of fun. Yeah, yeah. Sleazy. Yeah. Because it's the story, this character, Miss Wyckoff, is a school teacher. It's set in 1954 or something like that. The school teacher who's, like, going through, like, you know, quote unquote female hysteria, you know, like one of these kind of, like, they don't use that term, but, like, it's kind of played up like that, like this Victorian notion of, like, spinsters and, like, oh, she's, like, having flashes of emotions and, like, all this weird shit. So she goes and talks to her doctor, and her doctor's like, oh, you're a virgin, and you're having early onset menopause at 35. You need to get laid. And that's, like, the plot of the movie.
Really?
Yeah. So when I read that, I was like, this is going to be so dumb. And I thought it was going to be, like, kind of goofy, like, you know, hamming that kind of thing up.
Yeah.
But it's not. They play it like a very straight drama. The whole, like, drama of the movie is that she falls in or begins a relationship with an African-American person in 1954, like Montana or Missouri or something. So it's, like, about race relations in the 1950s and the scandal of a white school teacher with an African-American janitor, but also, like, women's place in that, like, in that world and, like...
Okay.
And Donald Pleasance is her psychologist, which is like, okay, that's cool. All that said, like, it just doesn't fit together, and it doesn't handle any of those subjects well enough to, like, attempt to do it. It's like if we tried to make, like, a student film with these very lofty goals about this stuff, and it just falls, like, so flat. So that was, like, $25 I wasted, I guess.
I mean, that is the danger of blind buying a lot of these like boutique Blu-ray labels. I mean, there's a lot of, like, really great, like, undiscovered gems on there, but some of them will only be for, like, you know, like a tenth of the people who might want to buy them too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like a lot of them are stuff that, like, a very small selection of people love. It's like 5% of people, like, really love this thing, and 95% of them aren't going to love it as much. And it sounds like you're in the 95%, which is.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah, I think it was, like, you know, it might partially be, like, my expectations just weren't what this movie was. Like, what I set this movie up to be in my mind was not what it was.
Yeah.
So, that's unfortunate. That's Good Luck, Miss Wyckoff.
Okay, now, you said Donald Pleasance plays a psychologist. Is he playing Dr. Sam Lewis?
Oh, man, you know, I wish. That would have been dope.
It doesn't take place in the Halloween cinematic universe.
No, No, the Halloween, yeah, extended universe. No,
look for away Michael Myers file away, and then get back to what he's talking about here.
For some reason, order him to be transferred to another mental institution where he's going to break out. No, that doesn't happen.
Bummer.
The next thing I want to talk about is Umbrella Academy.
In October 1989, 43 women around the world gave birth. None of these women had been pregnant when the day first began.
How much do you want for it?
I have adopted 6 children. Gifted with abilities far beyond the ordinary. I give you the Umbrella Academy.
Which is on Netflix.
Okay, right, yes. Now. The new, 10-episode Netflix TV show?
Yes, yeah. So, you know, I watched it.
Yeah, so you watched the whole thing.
Yes, yeah. I watched the whole season. I finished it. I watched it in a weekend. It's based on a comic book. I don't know if it's co-written or co-created, at least, by Gerard Way of My Chemical Romance fame.
Yep, I am familiar.
Yeah, which is pretty neat.
He's also the creator of Penny Parker, by the way, the Spider-Verse character.
What?
Yeah, Edge of Spider-Verse number 4 was written by... Gerard Way.
That's so cool.
The one that introduced Penny Parker. I own that comic.
Whoa.
Yeah, just throwing it out there. That's it. My Spider-Verse awesome. Cred. But,
yeah, you got to flex those muscles.
Exactly.
Yeah, and this is the story of these kids born with, all born on the same day and bought by this like eccentric billionaire, like gentleman scientist guy.
Yes.
And they're superheroes, or he trains them into superheroes and stuff like that, or vigilantes or whatever you want to call it. And it's this, you know, crazy time travel, like save the world bonkers story that's basically this like dysfunctional family drama set around this science fiction superhero story. And it's fucking great, man. Like I didn't really know what to expect going into it. And I was kind of there originally just to like experience the crazy superhero sci-fi stuff,
yeah.
But it's like really emotional and moving, and like I love all these characters. And there's this one character named Hazel, who's this temporal assassin, like time traveling assassin guy, and he's basically Dale Cooper. Like he's like got this like Zen mantra thing, and he like loves coffees and donuts, and like he's my son, and if anything happens to him, I'm gonna riot. Basically, is what I'm saying. Yeah, and it's like the music is incredible. And plays a very huge role in the show.
Nice. Does Gerard Way also do the music for the show?
You know, he might. He might be like some kind of music supervisor guy. I didn't really look at the credits much. I was kind of like listening for any My Chemical Romance, and there's none in there. At least that I'd noticed.
Right.
Which seems like a missed opportunity.
Yeah, well, you're saying it's a show about like a bunch of teenagers in like a school together, trying to overthrow this like kind of mad scientist kind of guy, right? That's kind of the basic.
I mean, loosely
basic gist. So you're saying from his perspective, teenagers scare the living shit out of me. They could care less as long as someone will bleed.
Yeah, basically. But the whole thing is they're adults now.
Right.
But there is a lot of flashbacks to them as teenagers.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of, like, good representation. You know, it's very diverse in all aspects and stuff like that. And I think Mary J. Blige is in it. She's the other... She's the second time-traveling assassin.
Okay.
And she's awesome. Like, she's, like, deadpan comedy gold, and it's
really
amazing. Yeah, like, totally bizarre. I loved it. Yeah, so that's Umbrella Academy, 10 episodes on Netflix. You know, watch, knock it out on a rainy weekend. It's definitely worth it.
Nice, yeah, but I've been meaning to watch that for a while, because, I mean, it sounds like it's right up my alley. I love superheroes, like this kind of, like, it sounds like a twisted take on the X-Men kind of thing, and, like...
Yeah.
And I've been a fan of My Chemical Romance since I was, like, 13. I lived through that age, so it's like... So, you know, I'm kind of stoked for that reason, too. But, it's Umbrella Academy on Netflix, and I think it's already been renewed for season 2, right?
Yeah, in classic Netflix fashion, I think the day or two after it, like, dropped, they were like, oh, season 2's coming.
Yeah.
Which is pretty dope. It is this weird, there's this one thing that's very interesting that I'd noticed. I think it's the first one that I've noticed, at least, of an original Netflix show that doesn't have an intro. Like, okay. Because they know everyone just skips it because they give you the option to skip intro.
I do not skip the intro. I watch the intro for all my shows.
Every time, all the time?
Every time. I hate the skip intro feature. I think it's garbage.
What a hot take.
I have very strong feelings about the skip intro feature. I think the intro is an essential part of... If the intro is there, then it's an essential part of the show. You know, it's you know, it settles you into the show for the hour. You know right. what I mean?
Yes.
You know, yeah. Like when I was watching Cheers, and I was watching that the entire. That's a long ass intro. I watched it every single time, and I sang along every single time.
Of course, you did.
You know, it's one of those things. I feel like, especially with there are so many shows with like cool intros that I don't like. Yeah. You know, the BoJack Horseman theme song is amazing. Or like, would you skip the Game of Thrones intro if you? I mean, I know it's a long one, but like, you know, to me, like some of the experience of watching Game of Thrones is having that intro start playing. You hear that epic music, that ba da 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 da. Like, you know, that's part of the show to me. So I hate the skip intro feature, but I know this is way off topic from what you're talking about.
No, but like it's just like this one, and it sort of is relevant though, like that the way you're phrasing it, where the intro kind of like sets the pace or sets the mood or gets you in the mindset. Because in Umbrella Academy, it's diegetic, right? Is that's like it's actually in the takes place in universe.
Okay,
like there's one that like I wasn't sure if it was happening. Where I was like, wait, is this, like, actually supposed to be for, like, take place within the universe of the show? Until, literally, there's, like, this big family meeting, and Umbrella literally goes through the window, everybody screams, and it pops open, and it says Umbrella Academy on it.
Oh,
and then, like, it just cuts to the net, like, okay, scene moves on. Because it's a lot of times where it's stuff like that, where, like, a door will shut, and on the back of the door it says Umbrella Academy or something, and they just continue the scene.
Okay.
Yeah, but, like, it fits, like, the mood and, like, mindset of whatever's going on in that scene in the show, in that particular episode, like, when they introduce the title. So, I don't know, that's like, a weird thing.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. Actually, Atlanta does the same thing, the Donald Glover show, where it's, like, you know, you'll see, like, you know, the show will be starting, and then, like, something will move, and you'll see the word Atlanta kind of somewhere, like, in the background or something, like...
Oh, that's cool.
That kind of thing, yeah. So that is, you know, my whole skip intro rant that I just had is... does not apply to Umbrella Academy, I guess, because it actually does kind of doesn't work around
but,
that.
Yeah, well, the way I just meant, like, there's no theme song, there's no, like, segment that is an intro. It just introduces a title in the beginning of the episode in the scene.
Yeah.
But actually, this discussion is relevant to my next discussion about intros.
Okay.
Yes. I'm about halfway through rewatching Cowboy Bebop, the anime that originally aired in like 1998, I think.
Okay, are you rewatching it because they're doing like a live action version on Netflix? Is that the thing?
It was this weird synchronicity thing. I have started but never finished Cowboy Bebop like 3 or 4 times, and there's no reason for why I haven't finished it. It's an amazing show. It's only 26 episodes. They're 22 minutes each.
Yeah.
Like you could watch it in a weekend. But it's one of those things where, like, I'll start it and be like, I'll eventually finish this because it's so short. And then I forget about it for a couple of years. And I'm like, I got to go back and start over and finish it. But I'm going to do it this time.
Yeah.
Cowboy Bebop has, I think, the best intro of a show of all time ever.
Okay.
Best song, like, coolest fucking... It's this, like, big band jazz song thing going on, and it's amazing.
So it's an intro you would never skip, is what you're saying.
Exactly, yeah. That's exactly what I'm saying. Just like Cheers, I would watch the whole thing every time.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, I don't think I really need to talk about Cowboy Bebop a whole lot. Maybe I do. I don't know.
I really know not that much about it, honestly. Because I'm not the anime guy. You know, that's
right.
You know me. So I know it's about like space cowboys or something. It's
like,
basically,
do you need to hear more though? Like, come on.
All right. Yeah. Fair enough. I've heard Firefly compared to it a lot, actually.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that does sound like it's up my alley, but...
Yeah, it's these two guys. Well, it starts out two guys are bounty hunters in the solar system, and they're just... Space cowboys, basically, trying to hunt bounties, and it's the classic, like, every episode, they never succeed in catching their bounty, so they're always poor, they always need money, and their characters are great, the voice acting, I've heard, like, you know, there's this, like, dub versus subs thing, like, you know, the dubbed into English version versus the original Japanese with subtitles, in anime that I'm sure Vin could talk much more eloquently about if you were here, but, this is, like, you know, one of the renowned, quote-unquote, dubs, like, people accept this one kind of thing. I think Steve Bloom is Spike, who's the main character. who's a, you know, very big voice actor. Yeah, and it's just great. And every episode is like, as a music person, I think you'd appreciate it. Every episode title is like a music pun, or not pun, where like some of them I think are like the Stray Dog Strut or like Venus Blues or something like that. But each episode, the music that like is in each episode is informed by the title. So like the episode with blues in the title, it's all blues music. The one with waltz for whatever, it's all like that kind of music.
And
yeah, it's pretty cool. It all is like very informed by music, and it's space cowboys doing bounty hunter shit. Like, come on, man.
I've heard it's amazing, and yeah, that's one of those things where like if I were to get into an anime show, I feel like that would probably be one that I could get into. So maybe one day, maybe one day. I know they're doing the live action version on Netflix, which will be happening at some point soonish, I guess. Right? Or I know it's coming to Netflix. Or did? Are you watching it on Netflix now? How are you watching it?
No, I am. I'm watching it. You know,
okay.
by means.
Yeah,
by
say
means.
No more. Say no more.
There's finally a Blu-ray version of it within the last couple of years, so it's available that way.
Okay. But I know it wasn't like a big like. Isn't it coming to Netflix or something? I feel like I saw something along those lines. Like the animated version
They're definitely making a live action version, so I assume they would have also gotten the rights to the animated version. But I don't know for certain.
Okay.
Yeah, and John Cho is going to star in that. I think we mentioned that.
No, I think we did, actually.
He's going to play Spike.
Yeah, because that just happened this week, I think. I saw that.
Yes, yeah. And that's fucking awesome. That's going to be great. He's, like, kind of old, though. Not that John Cho is old, but Spike is, like, this kind of, you know, Spike is this kind of, like, early 20s, like, hothead idiot kind of character. So John Cho's a little more mature looking than that. But I'm sure it'll be awesome. It's, like, cool. I'm excited for it.
Nice. So, yeah, yes. Cowboy Bebop. And
Cowboy Bebop is
supposed to be very good.
Yeah. And it's a great intro anime thing. That's how I got pitched it the first time I started but didn't finish it. Was like, oh, if you want to check out anime, you're interested in it, like dip your toes in with Cowboy Bebop because it's very familiar to American tropes and audiences and stuff like that.
Nice.
And then the last thing real quick I just want to mention is a podcast called In the Dark. This is a investigative journalism podcast. There's two seasons of it currently. The first season deals with, like, a missing persons case.
Yeah.
And they're both, well, the missing persons case is resolved. Like, it's resolved by the time the first season came out. And it's just kind of, they're both deep dive, kind of, like, looking into the justice system and law enforcement and just, like, the way they cover themselves in small towns and stuff like that. Like, the first one is Jacob Wetterling, I think is his name. It was a missing kid abducted in, like, 1989 in Minnesota. And it took them 27 years to solve the case, and they solved it by accident. Like, the police didn't actually solve it. Some other group of people were like, hey, we think this thing is related, and gave it to the police. And they were like, oh, shit. And then, like, so they didn't do their job kind of thing. And it's looking into the failing of that police department and that county sheriff department and stuff. And then the second season is dealing with Curtis Flowers, who was convicted for murdering for quadruple homicide in Mississippi in 1996, I think, like that. And has been tried six times for the same crime because he was convicted and then overturned on appeal and then convicted again and then overturned on appeal. And he's been tried six times and about how, like, double jeopardy only apparently specifically applies to being acquitted. So if you're tried for something and found not guilty, you can't be tried again.
Right.
But if you are guilty or found guilty and then it's overturned in appeal, you can just be tried indefinitely for the same thing. Which I had no idea, and that's very scary.
Yeah.
And it's about that district attorney and, like, the court system in Mississippi and, like, all this stuff. So if you're at all interested in being just, like, mad and being very sad about the state of affairs and racism and stuff like that, check out In the Dark. I think it's really intense. And, you know, every now and then you just want to feel bad about some shit, I guess. It's incredible.
Yeah, so that is In the Dark, and that's a podcast that you can listen to when you're not listening to our podcast, which...
That's right.
I mean, why would you even have any other podcast that you listen to, you know what I mean?
Yeah, we go for long enough. Come on.
All right, I got a few movies for my discussions as well, Mike. And, you know, the person who was supposed to be our guest today, Jordan, who I mentioned at the top of the show, he was going to have Beetlejuice, Tim Burton's Beetlejuice, as one of his discussions.
Right.
And he was, you know, excited to talk about it. I think he had not seen it before.
Oh, okay.
Which is insane. Like, that's...
that's like, you have to sort of try to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Honestly, like, I'm a little bit impressed they had never seen Beetlejuice before. But I love Beetlejuice. I'm a huge Beetlejuice fan. And that, of course, is an early Tim Burton movie. Well, Tim Burton just came out with another movie, Mike.
What?
He did. And it was called Dumbo.
Where are they taking her?
Take Dumbo back inside.
But she's his mom. Do something. She needs us. Look at me. We're going to bring your mama home.
Now... Why'd you say it like that?
With a bunch of disdain in my voice? Is that what,
yes.
Is that what you're hearing? Well, here's the thing. I mean, Tim Burton is somebody... We talked about Tim Burton a lot a couple episodes of The Complete Works ago on the death... We did an episode on The Death of Superman Lives, What Happened, right? Which is the documentary about the making of Superman Lives, which was a Superman movie that Nicolas Cage would have starred in. Tim Burton was going to direct. Kevin Smith did a pass on the script. And so it ended up not being made, obviously, otherwise... You would know about it by now. but we talked about Tim Burton a lot in that episode. And I talked about how, you know, that early era of Tim Burton, like everything up through Mars Attacks, like, you know, 85 through 96, like I'm all about Tim Burton. I think that era of Tim Burton is some of the most fun and inventive and just weird, like, Hollywood filmmaking that happened in that period. And Ed Wood, genuinely one of my favorite movies of all time. I love that movie. And then from there, like, well, actually, like, it's weird. Once you get to Superman Lives... I feel like at that point, a split starts to emerge in Tim Burton's career. Maybe that movie broke him. Maybe, like, the process of doing Superman Lives, like, broke Tim Burton. I don't know.
Yeah, he was crushed by the Hollywood system.
Exactly. And he has made good movies since then. You know, Big Fish, Sweeney Todd. I like those movies. But there is also, you know, movies like Planet of the Apes and... And there's his Charlie and the Chocolate Factory remake, which I kind of like, but it's iffy. Dark Shadows, and then there's the big one for me, like the big, like, you know, absolute turd of a movie, which is which is Alice in Wonderland, which is his previous live-action Disney remake.
Right,
so,
yeah.
And so when here's the thing about Alice in Wonderland. Alice in Wonderland, I tweeted this out before I saw Dumbo. Alice in Wonderland is a movie that is so bad that it ended my relationship with my girlfriend at the time.
Oh my god.
It is that bad. Cuz I remember I was 16, like she was like my first girlfriend and we went out and we were already like, you know, on the process of like not being a couple anymore, right? Like, we were kind of on the way out. And then we saw Alice in Wonderland together and I was just like seething the entire movie. I thought it was terrible. Like one of the worst movies I had ever seen. I was so upset about Alice in Wonderland. And I, you know, as soon as the movie's over, I like turned to her and I was like ready to trash it. And she looked at me and she's like, wow, Tim Burton's a genius. And I was like, what?
Get out.
But that was like the point where I was like, maybe this isn't going to work. And, you know, not that we broke up over Alice in Wonderland. Like, obviously, like, I'm not going to break up with somebody just because of a movie. But
you broke up with her because of a movie.
It, like, didn't help, you know? And I was 16. It was a different time. Right. You know, I was a younger and more immature person then. But anyway, what I'm saying is that Alice in Wonderland is a movie that is so bad that it destroyed a relationship in my life. And so the bar for Dumbo was very low. All I had to do was be better than that. And I think it succeeds in that regard. It's better than Alice in Wonderland. It's not great. But I think it's a more inventive movie than Alice in Wonderland is. You know, and I don't mean to just compare it to that movie, but because it is the other Tim Burton live-action Disney remake, that seems like it's the most obvious one to compare it to.
Yeah.
But are you a fan of the original Dumbo, like the 1941 like classic Disney Dumbo movie?
I mean, like, culturally, well, as much as you can be a fan of a movie you saw when you were eight once,
yeah.
You know,
yeah, that's
like...
exactly where I'm coming from too. You know, the original Dumbo, I know I've seen it because I saw all of those Disney movies at some point,
yeah.
You know, but I must have been five. Like there's no way I was any older than that. And all I really remember about that movie is the pink elephant sequence. And the racist crows. Like, those are the
the
two things that stand out. One of them is something that's very cool. Like, that, like, cool, like, crazy pink elephant animation. And the other one is one that, like, yeah, Disney would probably want you to forget about. Which I think is kind of why they made this Dumbo movie. It's sort of, like, it's, you know, sort of sanitizing it, kind of Disney, like, you know, modernizing the Disney aspect of it. And so now we have this live-action Dumbo. Which is directed by Tim Burton, stars a couple of Tim Burton regulars, Danny DeVito and Michael Keaton, both in here from Batman Returns. Ava Green, who's been in a couple of Tim Burton movies, and she's great. I love her. Colin Farrell's in this movie, too. And I would say this movie is not great. I think it's, you know, an enjoyable enough time. It's a solid adventure movie. I think the visual effects are pretty good. The child actors are like, there's two child actors in this movie who are kind of the main characters, like the ones who have the most interaction with Dumbo. Some of the worst child acting I've ever seen in my entire life.
Now, is that by Mike Smith standards or by real standards?
I believe it's by real standards, Mike. Okay. There's several, it's one of those things where, like, there are so many moments in the movie where the kids are, like, watching Dumbo, and they're watching Dumbo get in danger, and they're watching Dumbo do wondrous things, and it's always the same expression they have in every situation. It's, you know, Dumbo could be, you know, teetering on top of a tower with fire all around him, which happens in the movie. And the kid and the little girl will just be looking at him like, oh no, Dumbo. And just the flattest, like most unemotive, child actors I've seen in a long time, honestly. Yes. It also doesn't help that, you know, the original Dumbo is a 64-minute movie. It's barely an hour long. Yeah. That movie is barely over an hour. This one is stretched out to two. It's a full 2 hour experience. And it kind of, you know, it adds a lot of stuff and all that stuff. And I think it's more of like almost like a soft sequel to Dumbo in a weird way. Like, I feel like, as far as I remember the original Dumbo, like, I feel like most of the stuff that happens in that movie happens in the first like half hour of this one. And then it's like mostly a sequel to it. And then it kind of has this like weird anti-corporate message, which usually I'm all about. But this is like a big, you know, Disney blockbuster, and Disney is the biggest corporation there is. And I think it didn't help for me that, like, they bought Fox, like, 5 days before this movie came out. So, like, if that had not just happened, I might not have, like, you know, that might not have been an issue for me. But, like, when I was watching, I was like, this feels weird. Like, it feels hypocritical in a way, you know what I mean?
Yeah, does it feel like Tim Burton got away with that, or does it feel like Disney sanitized whatever version he made for that? Can you tell?
You know? I don't think it was anything, like, you know, I feel like Disney understands it. Like, they get what they were doing there. I don't think it felt like Burton getting away with anything. It's because the thing is, like, it doesn't really feel as much like a Tim Burton movie as maybe I might want it to be. You know what I mean? And I'm saying this as somebody who has not liked a lot of Tim Burton's output in the past several decades. But, it's been a while. But, you know, it feels very, like, heavily, you know, and I don't want to say sanitized, because, like, it's a Dumbo movie. Like, you know what you're getting. It's not it's not like you go in there for, like, the hard R edginess that you expect out of Dumbo. You know? But, you know, I think it's just, you know, Tim Burton's personality doesn't shine through in this one, I feel like. You know, the production design is there. It, like, kind of looks like a Tim Burton movie in some aspects. And, I mean, it's his whole creative team, right, who we were introduced to in The Death of Superman Lives. So, like, when I was watching the credits, I was like, hey, Rick Heinrichs, hey, Colleen Atwood, like, all these people. That, like,
I know those guys.
Yeah, good friends, all of us.
Friends of the show.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the production design is there, and the production design is good. It's generally pretty good in Tim Burton's movies. Costume design, solid. Like, visually speaking, I think the movie works. It's just that, you know, everything just feels kind of like roped, I guess. You know, it just feels like we did this already in the 40s, and we did it an hour shorter than, like...
Yeah.
You know, but it kind of feels like how I felt about the Beauty and the Beast remake, which, you know, the Beauty and the Beast remake, I think, is worse than this one. I think this is better than Beauty and the Beast. But, like, with that movie, it was like, all right, Beauty and the Beast is an 80-minute movie, and now we're doing a 2-hour version with a bunch of extra songs and subplots that we didn't need, and also everything's uglier. And that's sort of how I feel here. There's an inherent beauty to, you know, the Disney style of animation that has existed for decades. And I feel like most of these live action remakes kind of take a huge shit on that. Like, it's weird because it is like, you know, as I was saying, it has like this weird anti-corporate message, but it's also clearly like this corporate product that is remaking one of its older properties. And I don't know. Yeah. It's an odd movie for sure. And I think ultimately it's kind of fun. You know, there's like some fun chase sequences and Dumbo is cool. And no, Ava Green's in it. And like, she doesn't get a lot to do, but I like watching Ava Green. And so like, that's cool. But yeah, overall just Dumbo, it's fine. It's a perfectly capital F fine movie, that I'm never going to think about ever again. I feel like now that I've exhausted my, thoughts on Dumbo, like that's it. It genuinely, like, I was struggling to come up with discussions for this episode. And then I remembered, like, oh, yeah, I saw Dumbo. Like,
oh, yeah, that's right.
And that was, like, a week ago. You know, it wasn't that long ago. So, yeah, that is Dumbo. And I know I talked about that for way longer than I meant to. But let's move on to my other discussions.
You had a lot to say about Dumbo.
I know. But I want to talk about a movie that I really liked, Mike. I want to talk about a movie that I really, really enjoyed. And that is The Beach Bum.
I bought a second boat. Yeah. Named it Success. I just take tourists to the Outer Key. When they see a dolphin, I act all fucking stoked, right? Oh, it's a dolphin. Look at the baby dolphin. Look. Tell them to dive in. Make sure they don't drown. I only had 4 deaths on my watch.
Only 4?
4 deaths in over 8 straight years of dolphin touring. It's a terrific record. Now, I've been stripped of my license temporarily on 5 separate occasions. But each time I get it reinstated due to a technicality I never quite understood. It's beyond luck or karma, man. I'm blessed up, bruh.
Meant to be.
Yeah, I've seen many in this industry. They fucked with old Captain Whack around these parts.
Don't fuck with Cap Whack.
You will get whacked. Fucking with Cap Whack. What is this?
Which is a new movie directed by Harmony Korine, who was the director of Spring Breakers. Also, and it kind of broke into the scene doing a lot of like weird experimental movies like Kids and Gummo. I don't know if you know either of those movies, but Gummo was a movie that somebody showed me my freshman year of college, and I never like forgave them for it. It was...
Wow.
I might go back and watch Gummo at some point just to see how I would react to it now. But like when I was like 17, 18, I had a very visceral like anti-Gummo reaction. I was like, this is not for me.
Just like in your gut.
Yeah, I was like, I can't do this. But then Spring Breakers came out in 2013, and I loved it. Like I was a huge Spring Breakers fan. And that felt like a very, you know, it's weird. It was his most accessible movie at the time. And it got like a mainstream release. Like it was a wide release in theaters. And I can't believe it got a wide release. Like watching that movie, it's like, there's so much like prolonged scenes that are just like hyper editing, partying that are like 10 minutes long, set to like this gigantic dubstep Skrillex soundtrack. Meanwhile, like James Franco is doing the most insane performance of his career. And you've got like these former Disney stars just like completely like sexualizing themselves. And it's an insane movie. And it's also gets super violent and like, but it's, I loved it. I loved Spring Breakers. I thought the movie was awesome. You never saw it, right?
No, I never got around to it.
Okay, so, but now we have The Beach Bum, which almost feels like sort of the next logical step to Spring Breakers. If, like, the character, if you were following James Franco's character and he aged 40 years or something, like...
Wow.
Anyway, this stars Matthew McConaughey. As the main character, the titular beach bum, if you will. And this is the most Matthew McConaughey performance of all time. When you think of Matthew McConaughey, if you see this movie, you will think of the beach bum from now on. It is the quintessential McConaughey performance. In the same vein that like his Dazed and Confused performance is like his iconic performance, this is that character aged up 20 years and living in Florida. Like that's... the entire movie. And it's just this aimless stoner comedy with Matthew McConaughey in the lead. And the entire movie is just Matthew McConaughey getting drunk, getting high, having sex. 90 minutes. It's that. And it's hilarious and it's awesome. Incredible supporting cast. Martin Lawrence, genuinely, Oscar consideration. Like,
holy shit.
For your consideration, Martin Lawrence in The Beach Bum, he has this amazing comedic set piece that is like, you gotta see it to believe it. It's great. Zac Efron, who is insane in this movie, he's great. Snoop Dogg is in this movie as one of Matthew McConaughey's friends. Isla Fisher, who plays Matthew McConaughey's wife in the movie. Basically, the plot of the movie is that McConaughey plays this this once great writer of poetry. And he's like this very well respected writer, and he was like one of the best in the business. And he kind of marries into this very wealthy family, and he becomes like this just complete wreck of a person. He's
like he spends the American dream.
He spends all of his time on the beach, getting high, getting like you know drunk, having sex, all that stuff. Like I said, and then tragedy strikes, and something happens to the family, and he won't get the inheritance that he was married into unless he finishes his novel and publishes it. And so this is the journey of him trying to finish his novel while also going to rehab and all that stuff and just the insane adventures that he goes on. It's it's amazing. I think it's honestly like it's a more accessible movie than Spring Breakers too. Like I like Spring Breakers a lot, but that again, like that is, it's insane that movie got a wide release. This movie got a wide release too, and it bombed, and I'm very upset about it because like I think if the right crowd went to go see this movie, they would love it. Like if we showed this to our friends in college, they'd be all over it. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's the kind of movie where after you watch it, it feels like the theater got hotboxed while you were sitting there, and you didn't realize it until after it was over. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's The Beach Bum. I loved this movie. I think it is like some of McConaughey's best work. Just doing pure McConaughey, and it's a role that was written for him. Like it was designed with him in mind from the start. And you can tell, like as soon as he's on screen, it's like this is pure McConaughey. And it's nice to have a really good McConaughey movie because it's been a couple of years. Like the McConaissance kind of died down a little bit. You know, he's been doing more serious roles than he was like before the McConaissance happened, but they were all like for movies that like weren't that good, you know?
Yeah.
You know,
what was
like,
that one?
Oh, Serenity.
Yeah.
I mean, that one just came out a couple months ago. Yeah. Serenity, which is also an insane movie, but in a worse way. but yeah, I mean, Serenity was not very good. He was in like Free State of Jones, which was supposed to be like a big war movie that never really took off. And, he was in like, he was in a biopic about some guy who makes gold or something. I think it was called Gold, actually. Something along those lines. But the McConaissance like kind of ended with Interstellar. Right? That was like the last really big McConaughey movie.
Yeah.
And so now we've got The Beach Bum, and I will tell you, it is fantastic. If you can see one movie out of the, out of every movie I'm talking about today, Beach Bum is the one that's worth it. Like, I mean, wow. The next movie I'm going to talk about is also very good too, but The Beach Bum, like I need everyone to see this movie. but yeah, so that's The Beach Bum, directed by Harmony Korine. And then I finally have one more movie on my discussions, Mike. And I saw this movie over at the Roxy, which is the theater by my house in Missoula, Montana.
That you live right nearby.
Yeah, I don't know if I mentioned that in the podcast before. anyway, the Roxy was showing this. It's an older movie, I think it's celebrating its 27-year anniversary. And they showed it as part of Women's March. They were doing this whole series of movies in the month of March, celebrating women filmmakers and female protagonists and all that stuff, because it was Women's History Month. And it was also kind of a dual celebration of the beginning of baseball season. A League of Their Own was showing on 35mm over at the Roxy.
Hey, Evelyn. Can I ask you a question? You got a moment?
Mm-hmm. Which team do you play for?
Well, I'm a peach.
Well, I was just wondering, because I couldn't figure out why you would throw home when we've got a 2-run lead. You let the tying run get on second, and we lost the lead because of you. Now you start using your head. That's not love. That's 3 feet above your ass. Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris. Rogers Hornsby was my manager, and he called me a talking pile of pig shit. And that was when my parents drove all the way down from Michigan to see me play the game. And did I cry?
No.
No! And you know why?
No.
Because there's no crying in baseball. There's no crying in baseball! No crying!
Wow.
And I went, and it was awesome. I had actually never seen A League of Their Own before.
What?
Yes.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, so I got to experience it for the first time on 35mm over at the Roxy. Of course, directed by Penny Marshall, who just passed away a couple months too, so the screening was also kind of a tribute to her as well. And so a lot of different kind of things coming together for this one. And here's the thing. I'm not a sports guy by like any means. I've enjoyed sports in the past. But, you know, I wouldn't call myself like somebody who follows sports at all. But I love it when a sports movie can like effectively convey what makes a game exciting. You know what I mean?
Yes.
You know, because that's like, that's when I get the feeling of like somebody, like, you know, if a game is getting exciting and I'm watching it, like I'll get excited too. Like I was like, oh shit. If it's like, you know, it's the World Series, it's the seventh game, and it's like, you know, 9-9, and it's the bottom of the ninth, and like whatever, like
there's nine strikes, and
yeah, exactly. and things are getting exciting, like, but it takes a lot for me to get excited in it when it's a real sports event. But when it's a movie, right, like if it's just like really effectively edited and you get the good characters and everything, like I feel like if it can really convey what makes sports exciting in the first place, like I'm in. Like that's what really transports me there. And the final game in A League of Their Own is like one of the most exciting games I've ever seen on film or in sports, you know, it's
ever in history,
ever in history. It's amazing. I mean, you know, great supporting cast. You got a great lead performance from Gina Gershon and Lori Petty as her sister. Tom Hanks, just, I mentioned before, like, it's very rare that you get to see Tom Hanks be a jackass in movies, but he's a jackass in this movie and he's great. He's so good in this movie. Just an all around like great movie. Like I'm glad I've finally seen it. Like, it's one of those things where like, I feel like I should have seen it by now. And for some reason I hadn't, so now I've seen it, and it's really good.
What a way to see it, too, on 35mm. That's awesome.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I'm very excited. Actually, I mean, the Roxy just got their 35mm projector a few months ago, so that they've only kind of recently been doing that. But I saw Young Frankenstein there a few months back as well, and I saw The Singing in the Rain there, I think, like 2 months ago. And this entire month, very excited. They're doing a series of Stanley Kubrick movies on 35mm.
Wow.
Yes. So this Friday, they're showing Dr. Strangelove. They're also showing Barry Lyndon, Lolita, and A Clockwork Orange all throughout the month, all in 35mm, and I'm probably going to go to all of them, so...
Yeah, holy shit.
Because that's going to be insane, so yeah, pretty excited about that. So yeah, that is A League of Their Own, and if you're in Missoula, Montana, check out the Roxy. I feel like I plug them all the time, but because I do, because I live right around the corner. I don't know if I mentioned that.
Yeah, maybe they want to sponsor the show.
Yeah, you never know. All right, so I think that about wraps up our discussion segment, Mike, which was a long one today. But I think that means we can finally move on into our featured review of Shazam!
Baby Bats, I choose you as Jake. See, my names and my powers will become yours. Shazam!
Wait, for real?
Say it, okay? See my name.
Crazy, right?
What are your superpowers?
Superpowers, dude? I don't even know how to pee in this thing.
This is proof of authenticity. Super strength. Electricity manipulation. Hyper speed.
I'd like to purchase some of your finest beer, please.
Sparkle Fingers.
No, it's not. That's not my name.
All right, that was from the trailer for Shazam, the new movie written by Henry Gayden and Darren Lemke and directed by David F. Sandberg. It stars Zachary Levi, Mark Strong, Asher Angel, Jack Dylan Grazer, and Jaiman Hunsu, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Shazam reads... This must have been written by the studio or whatever, but it's the plot synopsis says, "We all have a superhero inside us. It just takes a bit of magic to bring it out."
Oh, my God.
In Billy Batson's case, by shouting out one word, Shazam, this streetwise 14-year-old foster kid can turn into the grown-up superhero Shazam.
Wow. It's been a while since we've had a very bad IMDb plot synopsis. This is one of them.
That's a really weird one. That's like, it reads like an actor doing his bio in a stage production.
Yeah.
Like you're opening up the playbill and it's like...
That's exactly what it sounds like.
Yeah, but anyway, so yeah, this movie's about a kid who turns into a superhero named Shazam. All right, that's in layman's terms. There we go. So, Mike, you know, we've talked about the DC universe quite a bit over the years. You know, we did reviews of Batman vs Superman back when it came out. We did a review of Wonder Woman and Justice League. We did not do a review of Aquaman, which I saw. I don't think you ever saw it.
No, I never got around to it.
Yeah, but that was more of a timing issue. We couldn't work it out at that time. But yeah, so you haven't seen Aquaman, but you've seen everything else in the DC Universe. Give a quick recap of your thoughts on the DC Universe as a whole.
DC Universe as a whole, at this point, is kind of like, just why? I'm kind of over it. It's they try to cram in and force so much of an extended universe and shared characters and all this stuff. And it usually is to the detriment of whatever movie I'm watching. Batman vs. Superman, we have to watch the sizzle reel for Justice League. where you have to watch trailers for all these other characters and stuff. And
yeah.
And in Justice League, it's basically the Wonder Woman, Batman, Superman show. And, you know, we have all these other characters and stuff that are, like, mostly there, I guess. And, it feels very corporate forced, like, oh man, we have to capitalize on this thing that's going on right now, make every movie possible, do it, and right. They're all bad, except for Shazam, which I'm just gonna preempt your
all right.
question, because, like, this movie's fucking dope, man. I had a lot of fun with Shazam because it doesn't do all that stuff. It,
right.
Like, I mean, it has references and nods and winks, like, hey, you know, of course, obviously, it's going to have that stuff in it. But we're not trying to force this greater, larger, world-ending story with all of these other characters. Instead, we're just kind of like, that's part of it. But, like, you know, it more is just about, like, these personal relationships with these small-time characters in this, like, backyard for a lot of it. And that's fucking awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Here's the thing. Okay, so, I mean, I'll talk about my DC feelings for a second. Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I think, you know, DC hitched its ride to Zack Snyder really early on, right? That he made Man of Steel, and then they were like, all right, we got to get Zack Snyder back for...
you're the guy.
You're the guy. Even though Man of Steel was like, you know, not everybody liked it that much, we're going to be like, hey, you're the guy. Make Batman vs. Superman. Make Justice League. And, you know, we were stuck in the Snyderverse for a very long time, Mike.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
And even that, it's like, you know, there, like, Wonder Woman was pretty good. I liked Wonder Woman.
Yes.
And I think, like, you kind of glossed over that when you were talking about the DC movies, but Wonder Woman was, like, their first, like, well-reviewed, like, generally speaking, well-reviewed movie, right? Like, Man of Steel got mixed reviews, but Wonder Woman, like, I would say universally liked. Like, it's not, I don't think it's great, but I think it's a pretty fun movie. And then you have Aquaman, which just came out in December. And you haven't seen Aquaman yet. And I would say I did not like Aquaman that much. I think that movie is visually really incredible. But I was not a big fan of Aquaman. And I think part of it, and, you know, there are a bunch of reasons why I didn't like Aquaman that, you know, I would get into if we actually reviewed it, but we didn't, so I won't get into that. But, you know, I think part of the reason why I think Wonder Woman is just pretty good, and I think Wonder Woman and why Aquaman doesn't really work for me, is because that Zack Snyder influence is still kind of taking a hold of those movies, you know, like, even I think he has a writing credit on Wonder Woman, and, you know, that has like a very, like, you know, grim color palette for a lot of the time, which, you know, fits that movie ish because that takes place in World War I. But, you know, it sort of fits that same mold that was there in Man of Steel and Batman vs Superman, and, you know, Justice League was the first one that kind of went brighter and bigger, but it did so kind of half-heartedly, and, like, it kind of fired Zack Snyder halfway through, brought in Joss Whedon, and it was a weird. Like, it's barely a movie.
But, well, he didn't get fired from that, right? Like,
No. He left because of a personal tragedy. But it sounded like they were going to bring Whedon on, like, anyway. You know, it was one of those things. Like, Whedon did all the reshoots and stuff like that. But then Aquaman comes out, and, you know, is a much more colorful movie, and, like, it's not really the color palette that's the problem, but it just feels like, tonally, it still feels kind of similar to the Zack Snyder movies. And, you know, it goes all in the comic book stuff, and it goes much goofier. But maybe it's because Jason Momoa was in Justice League or something, and it's just that mental association or whatever. But so now you have Shazam, which just, it's so different from those other movies in the universe. Like, it looks different. It feels tonally different. Really, what it does is it captures something that I think very few movies are able to capture, right? Okay, here's the thing. There are so many movies and TV shows that try really hard to ape those, like, 80s sci-fi adventure movies, right? Mm-hmm. Stuff that, like, Amblin was putting out or Orion was putting out. And so many of them fail. Like, so many of them don't do it well, in my opinion. You know, these are movies that, you know, had a lot of heart, often came from very honest emotional places, often had, like, kid protagonists, often had, like, scarier moments because they knew if kids were along for the ride, they'd be into it. And so many movies can't capture that. Shazam nails it. Like, it's fucking crazy how much Shazam nails that. It's one of the very few movies where I can say, like, this feels like something Steven Spielberg would have produced in 1985, you know?
Wow, yeah.
And that's the vibe that I got from this movie. So, yeah, I am with you. I fucking loved Shazam. And I did not expect to.
Yeah, I had a lot of hopes. Well, that seems like I was, like, you know, pulling for this movie. Shazam as a character is not really something I'm familiar with or have attachment to, like, generally. Yeah. Like, I have aware that this is a character prior to seeing the movie and stuff. So I wasn't invested in that sense. But then, like, it started having this, like, you know, the first trailer, I think, or one of those early trailers was like, this kind of looks like Big, but with lightning punches.
Yes.
And, like, if they could pull that off, they're going to kill it. And they did. They nailed that tone, and they made a superhero movie with Big. Like, that's amazing.
I know. It's exactly – I mean, here's the thing. Like I said, I didn't expect to love Shazam because, again, like you, I know nothing about Shazam. It's a character where it's like, you know, I think of myself as like you're relatively up on some of the stuff in comics, but there is so much stuff in comics I have no idea about. Shazam is a character. Like, I knew he was a kid who turned into Shazam when he said the name Shazam. I knew he has a villain named Black Adam, and that's it. Like, I know nothing about Shazam right. outside of that. And here's the thing about DC. You know, they've been in such a mess for the better part of a decade now that I figured I would, like, at best enjoy this movie on the level that, like, I enjoyed Wonder Woman. Like, it would be a fun time, and that would be that. But, like, just looking at the history of this movie's production, you'll see a mess. Like, they cast The Rock as Black Adam way back in 2014. We've talked about that on the podcast before. We're like, oh, yeah, The Rock's supposed to be Black Adam at some point. Like, that kind of thing. And he's still cast as Black Adam. He's still he's still attached to that role. But they cast him in that way before they had cast Shazam, right? They even gave him the choice, like, do you want to play Black Adam or do you want to play Shazam? and he said, I will play Black Adam. And so they started putting a Shazam movie together with the idea that The Rock would be the villain of the movie, right, as Black Adam. Because they had locked The Rock down in that role. And so they ended up casting Shazam or whatever, but then The Rock must have been, like, busy or something, so they ended up, like, this. They were already pulling this movie together, so they were like, we just gotta make a Shazam movie now, I guess.
No Black Adam.
Yeah, so now it's 5 years later, we got a Shazam movie, and, like, they're trying to do, like, a Black Adam, like, solo movie at some point. I think that was the plan now. Right, I think we talked about that like a year or two ago, like whatever. And The Rock's like a busy dude, so who knows if that'll ever happen. But you might notice he's credited as an executive producer on this movie.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, his name was in the credits in this movie. And so I was like, huh, yeah, that makes sense because like he was supposed to be in it. But so it's just like, you know, when you look at the DC universe as a whole, like, you know, we've talked about it before. They're just throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks. And I'm so glad that Shazam stuck, man.
Oh, man, yeah.
I think it's the best movie DC has made since Christopher Nolan was making these movies, you know, like before the cinematic universe stuff happened. And it's also just like a damn good movie, like outside of the DC stuff. Like, I think it's just a lot of, it's so good. And I think it stands tall with a lot of what Marvel's been doing. Like, you know, with the Marvel blockbusters, I think this is as good as some of the best of them.
Wow. That seems like a hot take. I'm trying to let it marinate for a little bit. I'll get back to you.
Yeah. And it did it on a much lower budget, too. I mean, this movie's budget was around, like, $90 million, which, you know, compared to the other DC movies, like, that go up to, like, $200 million, or the other Marvel movies that go up to $200 million, like, that's pretty impressive to be able to pull that off.
Yeah, this is a pretty low effects movie. I mean, there are certainly a lot of special effects.
Yeah.
But as compared to some of the other stuff, you know, I feel like this is pretty minimal. And I think that works. I think that sort of, like, Zack Snyder look is like a very CG special effects look, right? Like everything's sort of shiny and muted at the same time.
Sure, yeah. I mean, he was known, like, he kind of pioneered a lot of the green screen usage with 300 back in the day.
Right, yeah.
That was like a huge deal back then.
Yeah, and this movie doesn't really have much of that, which I feel like helps add to the, like, change in tone or, you know, like what you were talking about earlier.
Right. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it takes place, you know, in, like, kind of like city streets or, you know, home, like school or home or whatever. Like, it all feels like it's kind of taking place on real sets, which helps. There is you know, CG fights and stuff like that. And honestly, I think you can feel the budget a little bit during some of the CG fights. Like, they don't maybe look as polished as they might if it was a higher budget movie. But I kind of think of it along the lines of like Deadpool, where it's like, you know, the original Deadpool was made for like $60 million or whatever. and this often kind of feels like it's in the same vein as Deadpool. Like it's it kind of plays like a parody of superhero movies at some points, but, you know, for kids. Like,
yeah. That's a good way to put it, yeah.
Yeah, and so that was pretty cool. Even, like, you know, it kind of, I referenced Deadpool, but, like, even the fight in the city between Shazam and Mark Strong, like, that feels like it's directly making fun of Superman and Zod in Man of Steel. Like, it's
100%. Like, it's got it.
And it's like, it's making fun of your own universe, which is kind of nuts.
Yeah, yeah, I didn't think about that. The way this movie is sort of about kids that read comic books that become comic book characters, or a kid at least, or, well, he's not, whatever, you know what I mean. Yeah, like, it breaks that fourth wall. Like, it kind of plays with that idea that these kind of superheroic characters would have merch and comic books about them and stuff. Sort of like in in Logan, right? There's like the X-Men comics, like these serialized versions of the adventures the X-Men had. So like it sort of breaks the fourth wall in that weird way, and that's pretty cool. Like, I don't know, it's fun. Like, it's a DC movie that's fun. Like, right. Like, what?
Yeah, and how crazy is that? Like, if they can, you know...
It only took 10.
Seven. It's seven.
Yeah.
Not counting Green Lantern, you know. It's seven movies to get to where it is. But hey, I'll take it, you know. Shazam is real damn good. I was, like, you know, I went from, like, not caring about Shazam, the character, at all, to being like, holy shit, Shazam is my favorite DC hero now. How did that
ever. I'm going to buy every Shazam omnibus.
Exactly. Now, what do you think of Zachary Levi as Shazam and Asher Angel as Billy? Because they kind of have they share the role together.
I thought they were both really good. The kid as Billy is kind of annoying, but, like, in that kind of, like, precocious teenager way. So, like, but that fits the character. So I was like, okay. Like, you know, I think you're doing a good enough job to get me to Zachary Levi, which is what I'm, like, here for. He was a blast. Like, Zachary Levi is just, like, the most handsome and charismatic human. What?
I was going to say, were you a fan of Chuck on NBC back when that...
I never really watched any, like, I never followed it, but I have seen episodes, and, like, he's, you know, he's that guy in Thor for, like, 2 minutes, which is great. But, yeah, he's just fun, and you could tell that, like, they're, like, all kind of having a goof. And I think it comes through in the character. Yeah, so, and, you know, we've sort of talked about, I forget who tweeted it or whatever, was like, you know, all these other movies want to make the Avengers cinematic universe, like they want to make Marvel universe without making Iron Man first.
Yes.
And I feel like this could be the moment for DC. Like, if they make Shazam the guy now, I think they could have a universe. Like, I think they could pull it off now.
Yeah, I mean,
because we finally have that character.
Yeah, it sounds like what they're planning on doing is kind of backing away from the universe thing for the time being anyway, which is also fine. Like, I'm okay with just solo Shazam adventures for now. And then, like, I know they're doing their Elseworlds kind of Joker movie coming out this year, with Joaquin Phoenix, which the trailer for that just dropped, and, like, it kind of looks interesting. Like, it's a big question mark, but, like, now that they nailed Shazam, I'm like, more excited about it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, like, honestly, like, you know, look, comparing the upcoming slates of DC and Marvel, like, Marvel, we really don't know exactly when stuff is coming out and all that stuff. We have a pretty good idea of, like, yeah, we're gonna see Eternals and Shang-Chi, Black Widow, Black Panther 2, Doctor Strange 2, all that stuff. But it feels like we know what we're getting with Marvel, right? Like, it feels like we kind of have a sense of, like, yeah, okay, we know how these movies are going to be. We're going to enjoy them, and that'll be that. But, like, with DC, like, I feel like, you know, if they can make more movies like Shazam, I'm like, the tide might turn. You know? Not that, like, it's, you know, it's a very binary rivalry, and there's, like, you know, it doesn't really matter who wins or whatever, like, who's better, just as long as they're all making good movies, it's great. But, like, if, like, I enjoyed Shazam more than I enjoyed Captain Marvel and more than I enjoyed Ant-Man and the Wasp, and if, like, that's the case, and if let's say Marvel's next several movies, I think Avengers Endgame will be really good, but, like, let's say their next several movies after that are all going to be, like, Ant-Man and the Wasp level good, right? And I hope they're better than that. But I enjoyed Ant-Man and the Wasp. I'll see them, and I'll enjoy them, probably. But, like, if DC's next, like, four or five movies are all Shazam-level good, or even if, like, you get one Shazam-level good movie every couple of years, that's a pretty good run, I think. Like, I would be into that. Like, I don't know, man. Like, Shazam really broke me you know, we talk about Marvel movies so much in this podcast because they come out with one every couple months, and, like, point. And we've talked about, like, we're basically Marvel shills. Like, we generally enjoy Marvel stuff.
Yep.
But, like, Shazam, man, it could, like, change the like, this movie could single-handedly turn me into a DC, like, kind of fan instead of Marvel. Which is nuts. It's nuts to think about.
That's pretty wild. Yeah, I think if they really... I mean, they could definitely do away with the, like, larger universe. Well, at least, like, character crossover universe stuff, right? Like, there are references. They, like, have the Batarang, which was in the trailer and stuff.
Yes.
You know, if they do that kind of thing, that kind of universe, I think it would be a lot of fun. Although, I don't know, like, I haven't seen the trailer for Joker because I'm trying to, like, avoid it, you know, in general, like, the Unsullied thing. So I don't really have anything to say about that in particular. But, like, the concept is cool. Just, like, doing these weird fucking movies. Like I was saying with Suicide Squad. Like, just kill the characters every movie and recast them with new guys. Like, who gives a shit anymore? It's, like, you know? And I think it could work. The way it works in Shazam, if they manage to recreate that stuff in other movies, would be fun.
Yeah.
It'd be an interesting way to do it.
definitely. So yeah, I mean, yeah, Zachary Levi hilarious as Shazam, and I really liked Asher Angel as Billy as well. And I really like both of them have to have a good rapport with Jack Dylan Grazer, who's kind of like the best friend Freddy character in the movie, who was in It. He's one of the kids in It, by the way, which is the thing. Yeah. And I think they both have a really good back and forth with him, and I think that's a highlight of the movie for sure. Honestly, one of the things that most impressed me about this is that there really isn't like any big name actors in the movie. Like, you have Zachary Levi, you have Mark Strong, and Jaimin Hunsu, right? Those are, like, the three. Jaimin Hunsu is, like, a stretch there, you know?
Yeah.
But he's great. He's the Wizard Shazam. He's great in the movie. But, like, you know, with those the three known actors in this movie, and I guess the kid from It, you know? But, like, nobody knows his name. He's just the kid from It. If they recognized him. I didn't even realize he was the kid from It until after I saw the movie. So, you know, with these superhero movies, there's a tendency, especially in the last few years, to, like, stack your cast with, like, these, like, big, well-known actors, respected, you know, critically acclaimed people. Like, I mean, just look at Captain Marvel, which had, like, Jude Law and Samuel L. Jackson and Annette Bening and all that stuff. And it's like, this movie doesn't have any of that. And I think partially because of budget reasons, I would imagine. And I honestly think that adds to its charm. It feels like it feels much more like an underdog than other superhero movies do. You know what I mean? Even though it's still like a big bombastic superhero movie, it's a big blockbuster, it's going to make a lot of money. Like, it feels like it's coming from a much like a more of an underdog place. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it makes it feel more of like a passion project kind of thing. Where like this group of people that really wanted to get this made did it. Sort of like Deadpool was kind of like. Had the, you know, I mean, Ryan Reynolds is a bigger star than Zachary Levi. Right. But, like, this one guy or, like, this group of people, like, got behind it and were like, yeah, we're gonna make sure this gets done. And it kind of, I mean, I don't think Shazam obviously didn't have that production story the way Deadpool did. But it has that feeling. And I guess,
was in the works for several years because The Rock was supposed to play Black Adam 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, there's that. But let's talk about the director for a second, David Sandberg, because he comes from a horror background, too. I mean, he was the director of Lights Out.
Really?
And also Annabelle Creation, the second Annabelle movie. And I think that horror background really shows in this movie.
Yeah. Now that you say that, wow.
There's a couple moments where he, like, really doesn't hold back on some crazy shit. And it kind of felt like... It sort of made me feel like when I was 9 years old watching Gremlins for the first time and being, like, you know, scared, but also, like, super into it, you know? Like,
yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of what I was saying before with, like, where it started to feel like an Amblin 80s movie, where it's, like, you know, it has that kind of familial heart to it. It has this big sense of adventure, and it's funny. But also, like, there is some scary shit going on there. It's scary shit that I think kids can handle, which is the thing. Like, it doesn't show anything bloody. For example, although, like, some stuff happens that, like, probably should be, but, like, but there's no blood, and, like, it cuts away at certain things, but it's more about the atmosphere and about, like, kind of just the crazy monsters that you're seeing and all that kind of stuff, and I was super into that aspect of the movie, too.
Yeah. Yeah, hard agree. The whole monsters plot line and, like, all that stuff that was going on was, like, very intense for what this movie, what I was expecting going in.
Yeah, we'll talk more about them in spoilers. So they're not in any of the trailers either.
No.
So, yeah, we'll talk about them in spoilers. But I knew I would like the movie when I saw them for the first time. I was like, yep, I'm in. Like, that's...
Yeah.
What did you think of Mark Strong as the villain in this movie?
I just have, like, a personal affection for Mark Strong.
Sure.
Like, what a great dude. I mean, who doesn't? Yeah, come on. Look at him. He's so dashing. Yeah, I thought he was, like... He's kind of like on 11 with a ham, which is like fun. Like, it's funny, it's goofy, it's silly. And I just like him as a villain. He's like, you know, we talked about like Ben Mendelsohn.
Right.
Like,
yeah, Mark Strong was playing the villain a lot. Like, he hasn't really done it in a while, but like in like 2009, 2010, he was the villain in like everything.
And when he does, when he does his American accent, he's got this like talking out of the side of his mouth thing going on.
Yes,
and like
I think we talked about that when we were talking about Kick-Ass on Complete Works, actually.
Yeah. Really, I don't remember. He's like, I don't know. I just really like Mark Strong, and I'm like, look at him go. He's doing
fair enough. Yeah, I think he's a fine villain, and he is a lot of fun to watch. I think the movie attempts to give his character some dimension by like starting with his backstory first, and like how he hates his family and all that. And it's kind of sort of a mirror to what Billy's going through too, which I appreciate. But he never really rises above like big, mean, evil guy that Shazam has to punch for me.
Yeah. It definitely like feels like we're approaching like Beam in the Sky territory with him. But we don't quite ever get there, but it definitely, he is just punching bag man. basically. Yeah.
Which is fine. Like, for what this movie is and for what, like, it is the Shazam origin story. So, like, it's a serviceable villain that Mark Strong is bringing a lot to. And so that helps out a lot. And like I mentioned before, you can sort of feel the lower budget with some CGI shots, but I think it is, like, the movie looks really cool too, I think. Like, for the most part, there are some, like, scenes that are, like, outside that just look like, okay, it's kind of flat. But, like, you know, for the most part, like, whenever it's doing, like, the magical stuff or, like, the, you know, kind of crazy stuff that's happening, like, it's, I think the movie has this very cool sense of style, and it's, like, it's not groundbreaking or anything, but it's not, like, it feels more artfully composed than some of the other superhero movies that we've seen recently, like Captain Marvel, for example. It's, you know, even when this movie takes place in dark locations, you can still follow what's going on, which is not which is not something I could say for Captain Marvel, you know?
Yeah, there's it definitely gets away with this movie. It takes place in Philadelphia in the winter, so, like, there's a lot of just, like, gray clouds, gray ground. Like, there's a lot of that going on sometimes.
Yeah.
But, like, that, it still looks really cool. I mean, like, just the bright red, like, just Shazam's suit adds so much, like, vibrancy to it.
Yes.
Like, the bright gold and white and red and everything like that, just makes it, like, fun. I don't know. Like, that's really all I was hoping for with this movie was just, like, please make it, like, a good, fun, silly DC movie, and they just did it. Like, a lot of words I keep coming to is, like, it's just cute. Like, it's just a cute movie. And, like, I'm like, happy about it, you know?
Man, I know you mean that in a good way, but, like, I always hate it when, like, you know, we would go see a movie with my parents or whatever, and my mom would describe it as cute afterwards. I was like, I can't like this anymore. It's bad.
Oh, no. What have I done?
But, no, it's funny. It's fine. But, yeah, and otherwise, I mean, I think the sound mix in this movie is also, like, it's weird. Like, I don't mean to keep comparing it to Captain Marvel, but it just came out, like, a month ago. I was a little underwhelmed by that movie. And also, it's weird, because Captain Marvel and Shazam sort of have a shared history, because Shazam was originally called Captain Marvel.
Right.
And then they had to give up the name because Marvel wanted the name Captain Marvel, and so it's weird that a Captain Marvel movie and a Shazam movie came out within the same, like, within a month of each other, and Jaimin Hunzu's in both of them.
Yeah. It's really the Hunzuverse.
It's the Hunzuverse, and we're all just living in it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think, you know, with Captain Marvel, there was a really good opportunity for some of those, like, needle drops, those song cues, to have, like, a great sound mix behind it that we mentioned in the review that we did when Just a Girl drops.
Yeah.
Right, like, that should have been this amazing moment where, like, Just a Girl comes on and it's this kick-ass action scene, but the fight seems kind of weak and the actions and the sound mix is kind of, like, just not there. But I thought the sound mix in this movie, maybe it was just my theater, was great. I mean, there's a ton of energy to the songs and the way they're used. I think it's a better use of Queen music than Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, there was we already referenced Monsters, but, like, their voices, like, damn,
yes.
Son.
Yes, yo. Yeah, I want to talk about that in spoilers, too, because, like, yeah.
But just as far as sound mix go, like, that was, like, I don't know if it was my theater or not, but I was thinking of your story when, I forget what you were saying, was it Captain Marvel? Wow, that's weird. Where, like, you heard the We Will Rock You scene from Bohemian Rhapsody.
That wasn't Captain Marvel, but it was something else. And, yeah, I could hear We Will Rock You and Bohemian Rhapsody. Like, I could hear my theater rumbling.
Yeah.
I was like, what is that rumbling? And then I realized it was a rhythmic clapping. And I was like, oh, Bohemian Rhapsody's in the next theater over. That is a good sound mix.
Yeah. Where, like, I was, like, worried for the people in the theaters next to me. It was like when these monsters would talk sometimes. Because it's like that deep chest rattling,
right.
Like, Doom Slayer voice, which is very crazy.
Yes.
From, like, the Doom remake video game.
That is a very specific reference.
Yeah, it's bizarre. But
yeah.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, so overall, I mean, Shazam just... awesome. I think we both had a blast with this movie. And I will say, I mean, we'll talk about it in spoilers in a second. There's a moment in the third act where I was watching it and I realized what they were about to do before, like, right before they did it. And I had this, like, moment where I gasped and I was like, there's no way they could be doing this. This would be too insanely awesome. And then they did it and it was insanely awesome.
And I feel like you handle the awesome.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like you know what I'm talking about, but we'll... Yeah, you got it. But we'll get into spoilers, I think, right now, right? I think that sound good to you? We should get into spoilers?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's get into spoilers right now for Shazam.
Look, man! Stop it! Stop it! Run to me! You're spoiling it! You're spoiling everything!
All right, spoilers for Shazam starting right now. Hey, Mike, this week, I saw a movie about a kid in high school dealing with the pressures and responsibilities of being a superhero, while also fighting the natural urge to show it off a little bit to the city around him. That ends with a smash cut to credits that are drawn as sketches with a Ramones song playing on the track. But enough about Spider-Man Homecoming, Mike.
Yep. Yeah.
We gotta talk Shazam. When that Ramones song kicked in and it was over the sketchy credits, I was like, holy shit, this is weird.
They just straight up ripped it off. It's the same thing.
Like, it was cool. I liked it. I loved those sketches where it was like, you know, they were drawing all the different DC heroes and Shazam just kicking their asses. And like Shazam like driving up and taking Wonder Woman to prom and all that. Like, that's great. And it's playing a great Ramones song. I don't wanna grow up, but like it was bizarre because it was exactly the same as Spider-Man Homecoming.
I wonder if it was the same, studio or whatever that makes that does credits.
And they're just like, what do we got? What do we got on standby?
We have to make credit. We have to do the end credits for a new movie. Oh, shit. They just, like, took the other thing and redid it. Just
erased Spider-Man from the sketches and put it in Shazam.
Can I copy your homework? Sure, but make it different so no one knows.
Anyway, yes. So I think I knew I would like this movie about 2 minutes in. Like, about 2 minutes in, I was like, all right, I'm in. And it's when we're shown that the bad guys are going to be these giant demon gargoyles.
Yeah.
with super gravelly evil voices, like you were talking about before. Like, they just have these, like, it's the kind of voice where it's like, you know, you are the chosen one, and that kind of thing. Like, you are the evil one that we must pursue. Like, all that. Like, that is the level of, like, gravelly, cartoonish voice that is there in their entire character for the entire movie. And as soon as they started talking, I was like, yep, I'm in.
Here,
like,
we go.
We're doing the bad guys with the gargoyles from the TV show Gargoyles. Like, yes! Hell yes.
Yeah. That's exactly what I thought of, too.
And then they have that. And, like, here's the thing. I think the Seven Deadly Sins, like, there's more that could have been explored with them. Like, I feel like they never really actually kind of explore what each one is. They keep saying, like, oh, hey, that's Sloth, and that's, like, Gluttony or whatever. But they never actually, like, they don't really have that distinguishing of characteristics, you know what I mean?
Other than that Gluttony is big and fat.
Yes, exactly. And, like, Envy is short. Like, that's which it. Kind of plays into the end. But, like, that's, like, they don't really have, like, that much that distinguishes them from each other. But, like, still, they are seven stone gargoyles that are eating people. And I'm all about it. Like, that boardroom scene where Mark Strong kind of brings them and he, like, kills his father and he kills his brother and, like, everybody in that room. There's one point where they bite a dude's head off, Mike.
Yeah.
And I saw that and I was like, holy shit, this is crazy. Kids are watching this.
After he threw someone out, like, out through the 30-story window or whatever.
Yes.
Like,
Yeah, and it's great. It's so cool. And it's, like, it's not a bloody scene. Like, they don't show any blood or anything. And most of the violence is, like, implied. Like, it cuts away before something, like, really bad happens, you know?
But, yeah.
But, like, there was one point where he bit a dude's head off. And I was like, Jesus Christ, this is getting nuts. But anyway, they were cool, is basically what we're saying. They were a really fun villain for this movie. Anyway, so the moment I was alluding to before we got into spoilers, where I couldn't believe what was about to happen, and then it happened, and I was like, holy shit, like, this is insane, was during the climax when Billy's entire foster family also becomes their own versions of Shazam.
Oh, yeah, hell yeah.
It was madness. when that happened, as somebody who knows nothing about Shazam from the comics, I didn't even know that that was, like, a thing. Like,
me neither.
It apparently is. Like, I looked into it, and, like, that's the whole Shazam. Like, if you read the current line of Shazam comics, like, the Shazam family is, like, what it's called. I was calling them Shazam Team Six for a while until I found out they were called the Shazam family. But I think I'm still going to call them Shazam Team Six.
Why is it not the Shazamly? Shazamly? It's already got AM in it, like...
You're right. I mean, that should be the name of the sequel. The Shazam. Yeah. The Shazam.
Shazam-ly.
Like, that was just such a surprise and a delight, and the way it happens, like, it's just it's so much fun. That moment where he's like, he gives them the staff and it's like, say my name! And they all say Billy in unison.
Yeah.
Lost it. I thought that was incredible. And then they're and like, no, the name I say to turn to this guy. It's like, Shazam! And, like, they all turn into their own versions of Shazam, and you get these kids who, you know, you had kind of built them up throughout the movie, and you have, I mean, Jack Dylan Grazer obviously is kind of the main kid in that family, but to see him, who was, like, a handicapped kid and, like, unpopular, dealing, like, just becoming this, like, you know, superhero with, like, powers and everything, like, that was just awesome to see. And, like, the other characters, like the little girl who, like, is just like this super spunky adult, like, but acting like an 8-year-old, and, like, it's great.
Yeah, she's a Nickelodeon kid actor, I think, now.
Is she?
That, or like when she was a kid, she was on Nickelodeon. I can't remember like what show she was on, but I definitely remember her. Well, it's like, oh shit, that's that part. Like, what? That's weird. It's also crazy that they found, what's his name, Adam Brody?
Yeah, guy from the OC.
Yeah, the guy from the OC. They found a child that looks exactly like him. And, like, I was freaked the fuck out. Like, it was, yeah. Like, it's weird. It's
they kind of nailed much... it. They kind of nailed it for all of them. I mean, there was, like, a couple of them where it's kind of played for laughs, where it's, like the Hispanic kid who's, like, really big, like, turns into, like, this kind of, like, super strong dude. So it's not the same. But, like, with Mary, the teenager, I thought they didn't replace her. Like, I thought...
Yeah,
I thought true. It was the same actress playing her as Shazam, like as the teenager version. And I think they probably could have gotten away with that because, you know, she was like the oldest of the kids.
Yeah.
But no, it's actually like an actress who's like 20 years older than her, but they looked exactly the same. I was like,
it's very weird.
Yeah. So they nailed the casting on all the Shazam family stuff. And yeah, just like the chaos that erupts from that moment, just like it's so much fun, man. Like I could not believe that was about to happen. Like even if the Shazam family was a thing that exists, like that seems like something that like Marvel would have saved for the sequel. You know, that would have been like that would have been a Shazam 2 type deal, or it would have like hinted at like, oh, maybe we'll do the Shazam family one day, and then they do like 5 years later or whatever. In the same way where it's like in the first Iron Man, like Rhodey kind of looks over to the War Machine armor and he's like, next time, baby, and he runs away, and then he leaves the movie,
and he walks off stage and dies,
and then he walks off stage and turns into Don Cheadle. But yeah, so just getting that moment where it's like, holy shit, this movie went all in on Shazam, because I guess they weren't sure if there would be a second one, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Shazam's kind of like, who knows, like, outside of like people who like grew up on the TV show in the 70s, which was a thing,
which, you know, all 20 of those people.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I think I don't know if it was a relatively popular show, but like it was a show, and it was on in the 70s. So like theoretically there were only 3 channels back then. People must've watched it.
Yeah, you know? That's true. That's a good point.
So there must've been some kind of nostalgia for the Shazam TV show, but I really didn't see anything about that show in the lead up to the Shazam movie. And usually when there's a movie that has like an older show or something, there would be like kind of a retrospective or something. Like there was a new Hulk movie out, I'm sure there would be like, you know, think pieces about the old Hulk TV show, because that was a pretty monumental show back in the day, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, people who know the TV show, yeah, like my mom, I saw this movie with my mom, she knew the TV show, and that's really all she knew about the character. But like, I feel like most people aren't coming in with that kind of baggage. Like, this feels like a brand new hero for almost everybody. Like, this isn't Batman, this isn't Superman, this is like this kind of new hero for... like people don't have a lot of connection to.
Yeah, and it definitely leans into that, I think, especially because so much of the story is about Billy's discovery of Shazam and like what that character is and can do and learning his abilities. It feels kind of like introducing it to the audience. I mean, it is literally, but
yes.
You know, it feels like by design. But yeah, I just want to say one more thing about that moment when they turn into the Shazamily. And like,
which you're sticking with.
I'm gonna make a thing. When they like step out of the smoke cloud and you just see like the glowing lightning bolts in the chest, it was like a fuck, yeah, like fist pump in the seat, like here we go, it's happening moment.
There were so many moments like that in like the back half of this movie. It's
yeah.
I mean, I we talk about how fun this movie is, and it super is, but I also think it does a really good job of coming from a real emotional place.
Yes.
Which really works for this movie. So it's like one that's simple enough for kids to understand, because I think this is a much more kid-oriented superhero movie than most are, but it's also complex enough for there to really be something to dig into. The scene where Billy like finally reunites with his mom, who he's been trying to do for the whole movie. You know, he was lost when he was like 5 years old, and you know, he got separated from his mom, and he's been living in foster homes ever since. And when he finally gets reunited with her, and like, you know, she reveals that like she didn't lose him, she abandoned him in the amusement park that day. Like, that's heartbreaking. It's a really heartbreaking scene. And I especially love the way it kind of flashes back to that scene that you saw in the beginning. But this time around, the actress is playing the lines differently that she's saying. So, like, in the beginning, Billy's like, oh, I want a tiger. And she's like, oh, I don't know about that, honey. And, like, it's, like, kind of this enthusiastic thing. But, like, when you watch it the second time, you see it from her perspective. And so it's, like, this exasperated, like, the tiger's not going to be, like, that kind of, like...
Yeah.
Just this exasperated teen mom. And I thought that was, like, a really interesting... way to play that, and then that leads into, you know, this, that whole scene with Billy and his mom, and like he realizes he doesn't need her. She like she abandoned him, and he has this family that does like him and wants him, and they are currently in danger. So it leads into this, like, I think the most cathartic scene in the movie, where he, like, bottles up that emotion, runs off the roof, yells Shazam, and turns into Shazam in midair. And it's this amazing shot that really reminded me, actually, of Miles Morales becoming Spider-Man in Spider-Verse. That, like,
wow. You know,
that where he jumps off the building and kind of What's Up Danger is playing and all that.
Yeah.
But just really blew me away. Like, that shot, like, the way that shot is composed, where it's, like, midair, it's, like, the side profile, and you see the lightning strike him, and he turns into Shazam. It's great. It's so good. And coming, like, right off of that, like, emotional moment in the movie, like, it's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And then I really do like the way that pays off later, like a couple of scenes later when he's in the throne room with, what the hell is even Mark Strong's character's name?
that's the thing. You know, he's Dr. Savannah, I think, is the character's name.
It's Mark Strong.
It's Mark Strong.
Yeah. When he's, like, tells him, like, you know, like, bow before me and whatever, give me your powers or whatever. And, like, he realizes that Shazam realizes, like, he just went through this before with his mom, and he starts laughing at him. Like, yes. I don't need this shit. Like, yeah. I don't know. I just really like the way that pays off.
Yes, absolutely. And then, you know, you have just, like, outside of that emotional stuff, this movie goes insane. It goes
to, like, 11.
Yeah. You got that stuff, like, how the whole family follows Billy into the wizard, like, area, like that lair part where, and, like, you know, I wasn't expecting to spend that much time in that part of the world, but because again, this movie had, like, a $90 million budget, I figured it was mostly spent on, like, you know, empty city streets, like, that would be,
yeah
to save money and stuff. But, like, no, you go into this, like, wizard area or whatever it is, and you having to run around, and, like, they're opening doors, and there's, like, crocodiles playing poker, and you're like, what the fuck. Which I think is, like, a deep cut comic reference, but, like, to me it's just crocodiles playing poker. Like,
yeah, there must be. All those doors must be.
I'm sure they are. And then, like, go into the amusement park and turning into the Shazamly or Shazam Team 6 or whatever we want to go with.
Yeah, we'll figure it. We'll workshop it.
Yeah, and fighting all, like, the seven deadly sins, and, you know, honestly, at a certain point, I was like, this might be, like, one action climax too many, but I was just having, like, too much fun to give a shit. Like, it's so much fun, man.
Yeah, I did feel that way a little bit. That last third act, that climax there at the amusement park, kind of goes on a little too long.
Right.
But it's like, I'm still having fun.
Like, it sort of feels like Hot Fuzz, where it's like, you know, that Hot Fuzz has this extended action climax where it's
what
goes
a great
on,
reference.
It goes on forever, right? Like that last third of Hot Fuzz, it goes on forever, but it's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about that the Superman joke at the end?
You know, it's funny, my friends and I were just talking about before I had gone to see this. This was the movie that made Henry Cavill, like, leave. Like, because they were like, we want you to make a cameo. And he was like, I'm fucking out of here.
They wanted to make a cameo, but they didn't want to pay him as much as he wanted or something. And,
like, yeah. And then they do it anyway. It's hilarious.
And I think it was way better than if he had actually shown up.
Yes, I agree. Because, you know, he would have talked, and then, like, that would have ruined it. Gonna say he's in the cafeteria and, like, you know, his head is out of frame. It's like the best way to do it.
Yes, he walks on, he's carrying, like, a lunch tray, I think, like, he's about to sit down and have lunch, and just having a, you know, Jack Dylan Grazer Freddy like look up and just kind of, like, just freak out for a second, and then just immediately scream. Smash cut to credits. It's amazing. That was incredible. Like, and that's what this movie also does really well. It takes advantage of that shared universe thing without ever feeling, like, beholden to it. You know, it never feels like it's part of the Snyderverse. It feels like it's in this much happier version of the DC Universe that we just happen to be watching, that also has, you know, like, Batman exists, and Aquaman exists, and Superman exists, and Wonder Woman exists in the realm of this movie. But they don't really have that much of an effect on the story. They have no effect on the story. This is its own thing entirely. I love that.
You know, it was interesting, too. I referenced it earlier. Like, it takes place in Philadelphia. Do any of the other movies take place in the quote-unquote real world in the DC Universe?
Yeah, maybe Wonder Woman would, right? Because that's World War I. She's in, like, the trenches and stuff. So she's in, like, Germany and all that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. In the Louvre, I think, right?
In the Louvre, right. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, Superman's a metropolis. Batman's a Gotham City. Aquaman is the ocean. Which, you know, give it a few more years, it won't exist either.
Well, it'll be all that exists, actually.
Well, yeah, good point.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually, I didn't think of that, but like, it just like specifically names like a real life city and like is here in, well, a U.S. city at least.
Yeah, and it uses that, like, it uses Philadelphia like imagery and iconography. Like, it references Rocky a couple times. There's like one pretty great moment where it's like, "View from the steps is pretty good. I can see where Rocky wanted to get up here so bad."
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, and it adds that another layer of like grounding to this movie that the other DC movies don't have, really.
Yes. Yeah. What did you think? Did you watch both post-credit scenes?
Yes, I did.
Okay. So yeah, we'll say what they were and then talk about them a little bit. Okay. So first one, mid-credit scene, showing off. This is one of the, you know, in most cases, I can watch these post-credit scenes and be like, yeah, I kind of get what's going on, right? Like, I understand what's happening. And in this one, I was like, you know what? I mean, I'm into what's going on, but I have no idea what this is. And I'm guessing you had the same reaction.
Yeah.
So the first one shows off a character named Mr. Mind, who is talking to Mark Strong. Mr. Mind is a sentient, super intelligent caterpillar who is apparently one of Shazam's greatest foes in the comics. Apparently he's like one of the orchestrators of the original like League of Evil or whatever. Like, he's like, you know, he's the head of a lot of different things in like deep cut DC lore or whatever. But he's like this alien super intelligent caterpillar basically. And he shows up, you see him for a minute in the beginning of the movie. In like the Wizard's Lair type area, and then the ending is him kind of talking to Mark Strong and I guess recruiting him for whatever. But I was a little distracted because I was like, "What is this? Like, what is going on? What is this caterpillar?" But I'm all about having Shazam fight a caterpillar in the next movie. I think that'd be great.
Yeah, I had no idea what was going on, but like. And it's got, like, this robot, like, voice box thing it's talking through. So it's got this, like, silly Mysterio voice thing.
It's voiced by the director, David Sandberg. He's the guy who voices Mr. Mind.
Really? That's awesome. Yeah. It feels like something that would have been in, like, a 1960s Saturday morning cartoon. And I was like, fuck, yes. Let's go.
Yeah. 100%. Which is how a lot of this movie feels. I mean, those gargoyles and stuff. That's right out of Gargoyles. Yeah.
Well, when you put it that way...
And the other post-credit scene is just kind of a jokey one with Freddy and Shazam testing out if he can talk to fish like Aquaman and kind of dismissing it as a stupid power, which was pretty funny. You know, I enjoyed that. That was a good like riff scene. Not much else to it than that. Just, you know, cool.
Yeah, I thought it was very funny because, like, it felt like... I don't know how to describe it. Like, you know, he's like, this is dumb. Like, who's ever going to talk to fish? What would you even do with that? And it cuts to Freddy, and he's, like, wearing an Aquaman shirt. And I was like, oh, that's funny. Like, and then he, like, points at the shirt, and I was like, oh, yeah, Aquaman actually exists in this movie. Like, like he's a real dude.
Right.
I was like, oh, yeah, great. I don't know. There's layers. Hashtag layers, Mike.
Hashtag layers to Shazam going on over here.
Also, the layer payoff, great.
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, that was pretty hilarious. Like, I think it was during the montage where they're going to the real estate agent and saying, like, hey, we would like a lair, please. And, like, and I love that. There's, like, so much stuff like that where it's, like, kids trying to figure out how the real world works. You know what I mean? Like, now that he's an adult. So, like, obviously the first thing, like, a 13-year-old boy who turns into an adult would do is, like, I'm going to buy beer now. Or I'm going to go to a strip club and, like, that kind of thing. And, like,
comes out. He's like, I need more money.
They were very persuasive.
Yeah, it's great.
And then the payoff to that joke also, where they, like, the first place he thinks of is the strip club, and that's how they get out of the wizard area, or the lair, or whatever. Yeah. That was great. But then, yeah, the reveal that that's going to be the lair of Shazam Team 6, or the Shazamly, like, that was pretty great, too. Yeah, I mean, this movie just is so much fun, man. And I just had this goofy smile on my face the entire time I was watching it. And I can't wait to see it again, honestly. This is the first time I've seen a DC movie in a long time where I've said, I can't wait to see this movie again.
Yeah, wow. And what about the straight-up big reference, right?
Oh, yeah, there's literally a part where they're in the toy store and they do, like, the piano thing for a second.
Yeah, they run on a piano on the floor, and I was like, oh, yes. You did it.
Yeah, that's during the first fight between Shazam and Mark Strong, and that was a fun little shout-out. And also just that whole, like, I just loved... You know, it made, like, I remember watching that in Man of Steel, like, with Superman and Zod, and seeing, like, those two, like, superpower beings fighting each other and destroying buildings and shit, and I was like, this should be cool, but it's not. And this movie made it cool. Like, but also, like, goofy and, like, funny. Like, it balances a lot of things. I think it does it all really well.
Yeah, I even thought of that immediately, or earlier in the movie, where they're, like, testing his powers, and they're like, oh, you know, you can stop a locomotive or whatever, and then
right.
Leap a building in a single bound, and he just, like, goes through the window by accident. And yes. I was like, oh, like, what a slam on Man of Steel. he flies through the side of a building by accident. I mean, in this one, it's by accident.
Right.
And then the big fight scenes happen, and it's like, oh, shit. Like, you're actually slamming Man of Steel.
Yes. Yeah, it was pretty great. All right, I think we've talked about Shazam a lot, Mike. I think we can wrap this up. Right?
Yes. Yeah, what okay, a long one we had today.
We did have a long one today, but it was worth it, man. Shazam is so good. That's all. I think I would say let's summarize our thoughts, but I think they're pretty much well summarized. We liked Shazam.
Yeah, hashtag Shazamily.
Hashtag Shazamily. It's going to be a thing. Or Shazam Team 6. You know what? I'm going to go with that. You go with Shazamily, and we'll have the Twitterverse vote on which one they like better. tweet out hashtag Shazam Team 6 or hashtag Shazamily for whichever one that you think we should go with.
Yeah, you can tweet to at MDFilmBlog on Twitter.
Or at MSmithFilmBlog on Twitter. Way to segue that one. Great.
Captain Segway.
Captain Segway strikes again. and all of our podcasts and stuff, of course, over at filmbook.com, as well as Apple Podcasts and iTunes and Google Play and all that stuff. Thank you for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DiCriscio. And once again, apologies to Jordan Rodriguez, who was supposed to join us in this episode. We apologized to him at the top of the show, but you know, he was having a lot of technical difficulties and couldn't make it, which is unfortunate because I think he would have really enjoyed this discussion about Shazam.
Yeah, we'll get you on another one.
Yes, definitely. And maybe we'll have him talk about Shazam in the discussion since he saw it and everything.
There you go.
Anyway, don't forget to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to contact us, hit us up at mikeandmikegotothemovies@gmail.com. We'll be back soon with another comic adaptation. And this one, I don't know, man, I'm a little less sure about, but I'm you know, tentatively excited for. And that is Hellboy.
You like weren't positive about that.
Well, no, I'm a little less sure if I'm going to like it. I know that it's Hellboy.
Oh, okay. All right.
Just because I'm a huge Del Toro fan. I'm a huge fan of Del Toro's Hellboy and with Ron Perlman. This one's got David Harbour as Hellboy and directed by Neil Marshall, who's a good director too. But I know you're a big Hellboy comics guy. Or, I mean, you've read like half of the Hellboy comics there are or something like that.
Yeah. I have there's the four volumes of the Hellboy like omnibus, which is like all of it. And I've read the first two so far. I'm not going to have time to finish the other ones because they're like 400 pages each
right.
before the movie, but presumably I will know some of the story. I don't know.
Yeah, you might. I mean, I would imagine if they're going to do a new Hellboy, and if it's supposed to be closer to the comics, it would probably be the earlier parts of that comic.
Presumably, yeah.
But yeah, we'll see what happens. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that. We should, and we'll have Kyle on that episode as well, or we'll try to, barring any kind of technical difficulties.
Yeah, we'll find out.
We'll see what happens. We haven't had any problems with him in the past, so hopefully it'll work
out.
Well,
now we're dead.
Well, yeah, now that I said it, it's going to happen. anyway, and you can check out our next Complete Works, where we're talking Pay the Ghost, which is a supernatural horror film starring Nicolas Cage and Sarah Wayne Callies of The Walking Dead. She was Laurie on that show, Rick's wife, who was universally hated, I believe, by the fan, by the fan base.
Yeah.
She was pretty rough as a character on that show, but I'm sure she'll be fine in this movie. We'll see what happens. thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out.